Around Comics, Episode 33.
Chicago, this is Around Comics, a weekly roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner in crime and the producer of the show, Brian Salazar.
Hello, hello.
We also have our monkey in the middle, Mr. Tom Caters.
Hello.
And our guest this week is a comic fan of 35 years and counting. He is super fan Bob Breedle.
Hi.
Super fan.
Welcome to the show, Bob.
Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you.
Bob has come all the way from Southern California just to be on the show.
Guests of Around Comics Day at the Palmer House.
Nice. Right.
Or if they just happen to be staying there, we'll right. come get you to take the train.
We'll pick you
actually,
up.
Actually, I think he stayed in the room next to the guest of Oprah.
Wow.
Yeah. Did I?
Did you?
Yeah. I don't know. All I could hear was the Brown Line train going by every 5 minutes myself.
But there's an old Blues Brothers quote. How often does that train go by? So often, you won't even notice it.
Okay.
Tom tells me it takes 2 weeks to not be able to hear that anymore. I wasn't here quite
long
enough.
Trains only derail once every 3 years here.
They do not. There hasn't been a derailment since like 1979.
No, there was the Brown Line one 3 years ago.
No, they ran over some old lady.
No, two trains collided and one got slid. Yeah. Well, anyway, look it up on Google CTA history.
Hey, can we talk about comics?
All right.
This was L Train, Around L Train.
Yeah, the Around L Train podcast.
Your CTA podcast.
This episode of Around Comics is sponsored by YouBuyNow.com. Sal, can you tell the fine folks more about YouBuyNow.com?
Sure. YouBuyNow.com, your spot on the web for toys, action figures, collectibles, and prop replicas. Check out their excellent selection of DC Direct, Marvel Legends, Master Replicas, Star Wars figures, and more. That's YouBuyNow.com. And now, the good folks at YouBuyNow.com are offering a 10% discount to all Around Comics listeners. Just use the coupon code AROUNDCOMICS, all one word, when placing your order and receive an additional 10% off. That's YouBuyNow.com. Check them out today.
Have you guys been there yet?
Absolutely.
Tom?
I just bought a, now I can't think of the name of it. That monkey.
Read the script.
Read
the script.
They told me. No.
Marvel. It's actually the Marvel Legends, but it's Marvel Icons. The Iron Man figure on there is freaking cool. So, yeah, I'm going to be spending all of our sponsorship money right back at them. So, no, that goes right into Sal's account.
That's right.
All right, guys. Around Comics is recorded every Friday from 7 to 9 at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you. Remember that if you are here during show recordings, you get 20% off your purchases. Just mention Around Comics when you check out and receive 20% off. It is that easy. Our June contest came to great success. We had an awesome time with the haiku contest, and our July contest,
our mid-July
contest is all set and ready to go. Sal, you want to tell folks about the July contest?
Sure. Okay, the July contest is going to be a caption this contest, and we're going to scan in a very interesting page from a old comic. I'm going to take out all the letters from the word balloons, and you are going to have to fill them in. And whoever does it the best or the funniest or whichever one we like the most will win a free trade of their choice, $24.95 or less. And also, as a special bonus prize, you're going to win 10 25-cent books hand-selected by our very own Tom Caters. You may get such wonderful things. It's a surprise. You won't know until you receive it, but you may get such wonderful things like The Thing versus Rom, or what
I'm
other?
Sure they work out their differences by the end.
Brigade number four.
I'm sure there's a misunderstanding at the beginning, and then by the end they've come together to fight a comic foe.
Well, there's a, I'm sure there's a good moral to the story.
I hear there's a lot of Rob Liefeld art in it.
We're going back farther than that. How can people find the page?
You go to our website under the show menu heading. There's a page called Contests, and it's not there yet, but it will be soon. We'll have that page on there, and you'll be able to download a PDF of it if you want, or a picture of it. Or you don't even have to do it to the actual original page. You can just type it into an email and just mark it, you know, Word Balloon 1, Word Balloon 2, whatever. And then the winner will actually post it lettered. I think I'll hand letter it or something and put it up there.
Get those clicks.
Yeah, maybe
skills.
We'll get, like, you know, Tim Sale to do it, or I don't know, something. No.
Steve Seeley lives here. He's a letterer.
Yeah, and we'll put it up there and you'll win.
All right.
And that's it.
One last thing before we get to the meat of the show. If you like Around Comics and download us through iTunes, please be so kind as to leave us a review at the iTunes Music Store. Just takes a couple minutes, and we would really appreciate it.
I left mine last week.
Yay. Thank you. And it was a great review. Thank you very much, Bob.
You're very welcome. It's a great show.
I'll pay you off after the show.
Okay.
If that's okay. All right. Well, guys, we loved getting a chance to talk with Michael Avon Omin and Ivan Brandon last week, but I think that we are all very glad to be back to our regular format this week. It was a crazy week of recording, but those guys were great. Please remember to pre-order the Cross Bronx or check it out when it comes out. They were great, but I think we're glad to be back to our regular topic discussion with Wire to Wire Comic News.
I was so disappointed from last week. You know, I sat and listened to the episode after editing it. And I said, you know, we talked to Michael Avon Omin, and I didn't ask one Powers question.
Yeah, no,
and it's
one.
A book I love. You know, I've read it from the beginning, and it's like I didn't
ask
ever...
me, and I'll say what he would say.
Tom, when Michael Avon Omin created Powers with Brian Bendis, what was the motivation behind having a ex superhero as the?
I'd rather talk about Cross Bronx if you don't mind.
Okay, on that note,
maybe that's why I didn't answer.
Guys, let's stop hogging the microphones. We have a comic fan here that has been collecting for about 35 years or so, and when Bob emailed me and told me he was going to be in town this week, I thought it was a great opportunity to talk about how comics have changed over the last 35 years, and it opens up a world of discussion for us. We're talking about 35 years of comic books. But to give us a point of reference from where Bob started reading and collecting comics, Bob, what was the very first comic that you remember reading?
The first comic I remember reading was Amazing Spider-Man number 88. Came out in the early 70s, I think around 1971.
That was Volume 1, right?
Volume 1, not the new stuff. Stan Lee and John Romita Sr.
About that time, 1971, what else was coming out at that time? Like, where were the FF in 1971?
First FF I remember reading, and it was probably maybe a year after that, but the first FF I read was 97, right before Jack stopped doing that book. First Iron Man I read was in the 70s somewhere. I'm not exactly sure of the issue. I was a total Marvel zombie when I first started. I was like 10 years old, and I went into the different Marvel books. So I remember Captain America. It was the first issue I read was 130-something. It had a big Spider-Man cross. That's why I was drawn to it, because it had Spider-Man on the cover, but it had Captain America and the Falcon. Spider-Man on the cover was in the 130s. X-Men, I started reading. I remember reading a couple of the reprint books that they did in that period when they were reprinting some of the older ones, but I was right on board with Giant Size number 1 and number 94 onwards of that book. So,
you're not an old man. We're going to try and do our best to not make you sound like Father Christmas.
I am 44.
Yeah, you're
old-ish.
No, not at all. You're a fairly normal looking guy. You've just been collecting comic books,
except for the hooks.
Yeah,
the hooks for hands.
Very hard. And it's very difficult to keep
easier
my books
to
in mint condition.
Yeah,
you know,
hard. Where are all these holes in these books?
Well, guys, before we get into Bob's thoughts and our thoughts on how the industry has changed, Bruce Rosenberger from ComicsCast was kind enough to send in an audio file for us and his views on how comics have changed over the last almost four decades. So we'll be back in just a second, and right now we're going to listen to Bruce Rosenberger.
How comics have changed in 35 years. Great topic, guys. It's Bruce R. here, and it's really kind of strange because this week I've been driving back and forth to work. I have a long commute both ways, and sometimes I'll turn off the iPod and I'll start thinking about things that I want to talk about on my own podcast. And this is actually kind of sort of related to one of the topics I was thinking of. So since you guys are doing it, I'm just going to send some comments, and you guys can throw them around, but. My comic reading actually goes back a little bit longer than most, probably 40 to 45 years, But I was, I grew up in the early 60s with, the Superman and the Batman and, the stories that they had a one-shot story. It was fun. Boom, you were done. And then the next story was like a totally different subject. And once in a while, they brought back a villain or whatever, but there was no real continuity. So then we moved into the latter part of the 60s, and Marvel hit big. And Marvel had all these great stories with mythology behind them, with backstories. You had Spider-Man, which each story was a separate story. It might take one or two issues, but it was a separate story. But you had that whole really cool thing, his whole life, his whole mess of a life, in the background. And then you had the Fantastic Four, which, oh my God, the mythology and the the backstory there was just incredible, and it just kept building and building, one thing on top of another, and it was just amazing. And let's face it, all that stuff's still being used these days, Kirby moved on. He went over to DC, and he created the New Gods and the whole Fourth World thing. And again, he created this huge mythology that is still being used. I mean, in 52, it's, the fourth world characters are in there. I actually had to be reminded of that by Scott Sederlund at Wednesday's Hall. I didn't even notice up until that point, but in any event. So, okay, then we got into the 70s. Now, we had all these artists coming out of the late 60s. We had, Jim Steranko, we had Neil Adams, we had Barry Smith. I mean, we just had some incredibly talented people. And I think what happened was the comic book companies got away from the house style because they couldn't, they needed readers, and the comics were going up in price. The newsstands were starting to drop them, although the comic shops were starting to come in at that point. The whole distribution thing was starting to come in, which was a good thing for comics. But they wanted to give somebody, people something for their money, You also had all these young guys that were like fanboys back in the 60s and all excited about the Marvel. Well, now Roy Thomas and from the 60s there into the 70s, you had all these guys that came in and they were fanboys and they wanted to explain, they wanted to explain why Superman did this or the whole backstory. They wanted to build that, which was cool. And as a kid, I loved that stuff, they did sort of like the soap opera stories, which in retrospect are probably very weak stories, but at the time, for a 14 or 15 year old, they were pretty excited. It was pretty exciting stuff. We moved into the 80s, and then there was this big rush of, the comic book shops and all these small companies started putting out comics. And then there was just an amazing amount of stuff. There was good stuff, there was bad stuff, but there, you had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You had people putting out comic. Everybody was putting out a comic book in the 80s. And Marvel and DC said, "Whoa, wait a minute! These people are getting our money. Let's put out more. If they've got more money to spend, let's put out more titles." They flooded the market. They put comic book shops out of business. They ran all these small companies out of business. But it looks to me like that's what they were trying to do. So they didn't want anybody else to have their money. So then we, slowly. Built back up, because you had a lot of good writers coming in now. You had the Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Peter David. You had all these guys that were writing really good stories, And then we got into the 90s. we got all these young, hot artists, even in the 80s. You know, you had your Todd McFarlane, Eric Larson, Rob Liefeld, and I'll leave it to you as to whether or not he's a good artist, but nevertheless, he was a hot artist. And these guys got together and they said, well, wait a minute, you know, Marvel's making all the money, we're doing all the work, we're going to put out our own comics. But their credo was basically, we're putting out comics that look good. You know, we're artists and we want to turn out stuff that looks good. We don't really care that much about the story. So that brought in, you know, because the cost of these comics or the value of these comics were going up, that brought in all the speculators. And all the speculators, they were just glorified baseball card collectors. They didn't care about what was in the comic. They just wanted a fancy cover so they could, you know, put it in a plastic bag and sell it for six times what they paid for it the next day. And they almost killed the business, you know. I mean, and I'm not blaming them. It was just a mishmash of everybody. But, you know, it almost killed the business. You know, all these, you know, foil covers and eight different variant covers, hologram covers, you know, all that crap that, let's face it, you know, most people I've talked to almost got out of collecting comics in the 90s because it was such crap, you know. Once we realized we were just buying crap, we stopped. So then things, again, slowly started building back up, and we're headed into what right now is a really nice time. You know, we have all these great writers, you know. We have all these great artists. They're putting together great comic books. And, of course, there's some bad ones. But what scares me, though, is there's this huge influx of small companies. And I just see that whole 80s thing happening again. You know, Marvel and DC, they don't want to lose their market. They feel like, hey, these are our dollars. You know, we're going to put out more titles. We're going to flood the market, you know. And I'm starting to see an influx of those 90s style artists. And I know I've picked on David Finch, and I don't mean to pick on anybody. I mean, but that's the style of art that they were. Look at David Finch's artwork and look at the 90s and tell me he's not a, you know, he's just not a, okay, maybe he's a little bit better than Rob Liefeld. But, you know, it's that same thing over again, and it scares me. I don't want to see this happening again. And the prices are going up horrendously, and I'm just really scared about what's going to happen, you know. The good news is sales are picking up on books, so I don't know. I guess that's how I see comics having changed in the last 35 years. I'd be curious to hear what you guys have to say. Talk to you later.
All right, we'd like to thank Bruce for sending that in. I think that is a really nice overview of four decades of comics.
But he's insane.
Well, that Bruce.
I'm a little disturbed that Bruce, like, he admitted that he actually turns his podcast, his iPod off from time to time, and that disturbs me. He should never turn it off.
Ever. Because it'll die.
But, well, Mom, you know, as we were listening to that, Mark was whispering in my ear that you know, the he got really worked up. Bruce did in that, and Mark got a little worked up because he was you know, he disagreed with his opinion on why so many comic shops closed in the 90s, but
God willed it. Yeah. He decided.
But that could be a whole nother topic.
Yeah, I think
the bottom line of shops closing, I think Mark would agree, is the probably poor business practices on many of the smaller comic shop owners, combined with in the 90s the Heroes World distribution thing that Marvel did, where discounts got cut to the shops. That really was the nail in the coffin, especially if you were in a bad place as far as smart business practices.
Sure.
That was the nail, the final nail.
I think the biggest thing is that the market didn't stay large enough to sustain the amount of shops that were out there.
Right.
You had the boom in comic sales that sustained that amount of shops, but whenever those people stopped speculating, those shops didn't have a customer base to support the stores, and no customers,
and,
no store.
And God's will.
And God's will. Well, I tell you what, guys. I think that Bruce's segment was a great way to kind of overview that you know,
sure,
four decades. We're going to get into some of the points that were brought up on our forum this week, and there was like 14 pages of printed post on the forum, so we're not going to read all of them.
Double spacing.
Hey, can I just wanted to mention something, as long as we're talking about the forum, that we closed our forum on the Comic Geek Speak website this week, and some people had asked us why we did and everything, and it had nothing to do with our relationship with them.
Oh, heavens, those guys are great.
Yeah, they helped us out a lot when we started out, and they've been great to us and everything. It was just simply a matter of too much for us to do to handle both forums. And so that forum is closed from now on, but we have our forum at aroundcomics.com.
And a big thank you to the CGS guys for helping us out. And there was in no way any bad blood involved with that. And we're looking forward to meeting those guys in August when they come here for Wizard World.
We're looking forward to meeting them. hugs!
But if you want to post at aroundcomics.com, that is where our forum is now and will forever stay. So.
I understand Tom is going to sit in Jamie D's lap in Wizard World August.
Oh, my Lord.
No, Jamie D isn't coming because he heard that Tom was going to sit in his lap.
I didn't say anything about sitting in anything.
Whatever you do, just don't let Raven Gregory sit in your lap.
Because he'll do it.
And he will hurt you. He's a large, large man. And last year he gave me a lap dance, and it was horrible.
And buy the gift.
If you run up and hug me, I'll buy you a drink. You can run just a big old bear hug, anyone who wants to.
Oh, and people have also asked, and I posted this on the forum, but I might as well say it too, is people have asked about Wizard World Chicago and what kind of presence we're going to have there. And we're not really going to have
any. We'll be
there. Yeah, we'll be there. We'll be running around. But I personally will be at Knuckles from 8 to 12 every evening for a personal one-on-one Q&A with anyone that wants to buy me drinks. So that's our presence pretty much.
Let's get back to the topic.
Okay. What I was saying is that we had so many... We had so many posts out there that we kind of boiled them down into sections, so we're not going to read a lot of the individual posts, but I would like to thank Papercut and Weak Rocker and Bernie and D. Drace and Vince B. and Ken Small and Rudiger and Wet Rats and Braxton. You all contributed to this, and we thank you very, very much. So, all right, the first one that we started boiling down to and how comics have changed is serialization. How much like a television season comics have been moving towards self-contained storylines and limited series arcs. And
well, the trade arc. I mean, that's sort of
no, even beyond that, and we get to trades later on in this, but just the serialization of it in that. I remember growing up that, you know, even like the Dark Phoenix saga, this is before trades, but it was more of a serialized comic. It was a series that one comic led into another one. You had cliffhangers, and maybe Bob can help us out, but when you started reading comic books, they were really a lot of series of one-shot comics, correct?
Actually, there were continued stories, at least at Marvel back then, because I remember the very first comic I read, you know, the Spider-Man 88, it had Dr. Octopus, and it had Dr. Octopus's arms kind of, it was continued from the previous issue, which I had not seen, and his arms were kind of going across the city by themselves. The next issue had Dr. Octopus, you know, then there were several issues with Green Goblin, and the story pretty much did continue. It's not the same as the arcs now.
But you could still read one issue.
You could read one issue,
and it was fine.
It was exactly. That's the difference, because now you read something that's kind of like, you know, the common thing is people say writing for the trade, where you can read the first two issues of a series and have no idea what in the world is going on in that series, you know, until you get the whole thing. But there, each issue pretty much stood by itself, and it might have had a continuing thread that would go on to another one, but each individual issue could be read and enjoyed by itself. And since back then there were no comic shops, I mean, I got them off the rack at the, this is different than you guys, but, you know, we had liquor stores where I used to, you know, here in Chicago, a liquor store just sells liquor, right?
Yeah. Cigarettes.
In California, you know, that was basically the precursor to the 7-Eleven or something. I mean, they had candy in a magazine rack or whatever. But I would go there, and they would have a rack of comic books. But you didn't know from month to month.
So you'd pick up Amazing Spider-Man and a pint and go off to the
at 10.
Let me tell you something, Craven, perhaps.
But I think that's, you know, I think Stan got that, talking about the cliffhangers. But the whole idea of that was that, you know, Peter may have saved Aunt May from, you know, the Green Goblin or whoever, but at the end of that issue, then you saw the teaser for the next issue, the silhouetted Doc Ock, and that was enough to get you to come back the next month, but it wasn't integral maybe to that story.
A hallmark of Spider-Man back then in a lot of the books was that last page really was a pretty good hook in many cases to the next issue that was going to come out, and it made you want to get that next issue, which was, you know, all the more frustrating when you know you couldn't find it at the local shop. You know,
the one at the liquor store.
Well, one of those things. One of the things that when I read old comics that they do really well is they'll just have a panel referencing something that isn't integral to the story, but you know, carries through the whole theme of it, which is kind of a cool way of doing it, because if you're reading it and you don't get the next issue, you can just be like, oh, I don't know what that is, but it's not going to wreck your enjoyment of the story. It's like just a little sideways reference.
Right.
Yeah,
I used to like those footnotes.
I miss the footnotes, the little asterisk of, you know, well, whenever I was...
Editor's
note. Yeah, the editor's notes. I miss those. Those were so fun.
You see them again? I've seen them recently here and there. People,
but they're almost kind of a joke or a nod. It's not... I mean, that was just part of reading comics. You'd get the editor's note. And it was totally a marketing ploy to get you to pick up that, you know, when Spider-Man's swinging through Central Park and he talks about, you know, meeting the Thing, and it would be, you know, go see Marvel team-up, you know, issue,
versus
whatever.
Rom. But I think it would also look weird to have those, because I think older issues also were more wordy. It was more commonly accepted to have more words on the page. Like, if you look at, you know, pick up an issue of any of the big two, you know, there'll be panels without words. You know, like, how weird would it be for someone to be like, oh, I remember last time you did this, and then like a box in the corner. It'd be like almost shocking to see, like, with modern art and modern sort of exposition, to see
like
that
the thought
page.
Balloons going away.
Yeah.
Okay, you, really you guys are getting ahead of me.
Hold on. Before we go, the serialization, though, I mean, isn't that sort of, didn't it just sort of form from, you know, cartoon strips and newspapers? It was sort of same sort of thing, and obviously radio at the time, you know, before then, you know, before the 70s, obviously way back, you know, in the 40s, 30s, and 40s, but I think that's sort of where it graduated from, you know, specifically, you know, comic strips in newspapers. I mean, that was, you know,
well,
you look
I think the evolution of television and how that kind of trained American the American consumer, that this is how your entertainment is delivered, and that serialization through TV episodes, I think, became, you know, kind of ingrained in how we receive our entertainment. So
I think it's more, you know, if you actually boil it down to TV as opposed to primetime TV, which I think you were referring to, I think it's much more like the daytime soap operas.
Yes.
Because primetime TV, while you had, you know, common characters, you know, if you would watch, you know, Gunsmoke or I Love Lucy or whatnot, they had the same characters week to week, but there very rarely was any reference to specific events, you know, forward or backward,
right.
And each episode was almost completely self-contained, whereas
yeah, right.
on a soap opera, you know, you have those stories where they have the same kind of cliffhangers, and, you know, the specific elements of the story carry forward, you know, someone is someone's evil twin, or
comics are soap operas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're soap operas for, you know, teens or whatever.
Let's
move on to
20s.
Accessibility 30s, accessibility to creators. And this is something that I think we've seen really in the last 10 years really change. The internet and conventions have given artists and writers and publishers more contact with fans than ever before. So we'll go back to Bob. What would you have had to gone through to meet Stan Lee or Jack Kirby in the 70s?
There was zero accessibility as far as I mean. I, when I was a kid, I hadn't, you know, the San Diego Con was probably going on back then. I'm sure it was. It's been 30 some odd years that it's been going on, but I didn't go to it until I was much older. In general, your only interface was you would write a physical paper letter and send it in, and, you know, circulation was much higher back then. You know, you would be selling hundreds of thousands of issues, and the interaction was pretty much limited to the three or four letters or five letters that would get on the letters page out of hundreds of thousands of people. Now, a book might sell, you know, mainstream 20 to 80,000 for the mid-range books. You know, the indies, you're selling, you know, maybe 3,000 to 5,000, and you can send emails directly to the creators, and they'll respond to you, or you can listen to them on a podcast like this, or you can, well, there's so many more
message
conventions
boards,
now.
There's message boards.
You can meet them at conventions, which there are a lot more conventions. Back
did you ever
then,
get
a,
did you ever get any letters?
I don't know. I wrote letters I don't know if they were published because I didn't back then get every single issue. I once got a no prize from Marvel.
Nice.
All right.
And what was the no prize?
Nothing. It was an empty envelope. When I got it, I was probably about 11 or 12, and I was so excited. I got this envelope. It was, you know, had a little bold thing in the upper corner that says, "In this envelope is the valuable Marvel no prize, which you have just won." And I was so giddy. I, like, tore the envelope open, totally ruined it.
That was the prize.
And there was nothing in there, and I'm like, man, they hosed me.
I hate you, Stanley.
Do you remember what you won it for?
I wrote a letter comparing the Justice League to the Avengers in an unfavorable fashion towards the Justice League, obviously.
Settle down, Tom.
What year was this?
I go by the handle JLA fan now, so, you know, things change, right?
What year
it was
it?
Probably 74. I was, you know, 12. I mean, but I was, you know,
caves.
I was late. Well, it wasn't, you know, it was like Marvel characters. It was like, you know, Hawkeye can beat Green Arrow and all.
No, that's ridiculous.
I know that now that sensibility of an adult, but, you know, as a child.
Well, he doesn't mean the concept's ridiculous, just the idea that Hawkeye could be Green
he's
Arrow.
He's a criminal.
It could happen.
Well,
no.
What's funny is, I was telling Bob about this, I just picked up the new issue of Alter Ego, which is all about the Silver Age, and there's an interview with Julius Schwartz from 1966 talking about the Showcase number 4, which was the birth of the Silver Age. And in 1966, he was bitching about people writing in letters to fanzines and how, like, their uninformed opinions were, like, ridiculous, and how they just fed off rumors and would just repeat things that other people said.
Oh,
and I read it, and I was like, oh, my God, imagine...
Now, with the internet?
Do you think now?
Yeah, exactly. I was reading it, and I swear to God, you could cut that out and replace fanzine with form.
What issue is Showcase number 4?
Of what?
Was it the
Alter Ego.
It was an alter ego.
I'm talking about the actual... So, Bob, do you have that one?
I don't know Showcase number 4. I have Showcase number 22.
Okay, which was?
First appearance of the Silver Age Green Lantern.
Green Lantern.
I have the first Silver Age Aquaman and the first Silver Age Hawkman.
Lord.
I don't have the Flash. I mean, that Showcase 4 is...
That's way
pretty
up there.
That's out of my league, but
are
I
you,
got the
Are you
JLA
looking
books.
To adopt any 33-year-old
Ben? I think for anyone who'd want to read.
I got into that, you know, a while ago before. Like, right now, things are... quite hefty, you know, prices. Yeah. In the last 5-10 years, the back issue market has gone really pretty crazy. I picked up a lot of those books, you know, 10 to 15 years ago, and they weren't that expensive.
Right.
I mean, I'm not buying mint condition books. I collect in, like, very good defined condition, mostly on those things that I buy, but they weren't that bad to get, you know, back then. It was mostly I would pick them up at the San Diego Con. That is the one that I would really like to get, Showcase number 4. That one and Fantastic Four number 1. You know, I would really like to get
the two big milestones.
Those are absolute landmarks.
Yeah, those are both big landmarks, and they're both, unfortunately, you know,
if I had
that kind of money,
price.
I don't think I would spend it on a single issue of a comic.
I'd read it and then throw it away. No,
sure.
Well, back to the accessibility of creators. I know, you know, I was, and once again, I have such a bad memory. I can't remember who it was. It might have been Brian Bendis, or somebody was on a podcast talking about that issue and saying that, you know, actually, it might have been, I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter who it was. Some older creator, and he was saying, you know, back, you know, years ago, they had no feedback. They had no idea when they put something out if it was good or bad or liked or not liked. They had no clue. They would get the letters, you know, a month later or 2 months later, whatever it would be. And now today it's, you know, instant feedback. You have, you know...
The day before
it comes out. I mean, you know, the
Which
previews...
Could be a good thing and a bad thing.
Well, certainly. You know, and I think, you know, they... You know, there's a lot of creators out there now that offer a lot of accessibility for their fans. Brian Bendis is on his message board all the time, and there are different guys that are online all the time, and there are, you know, a lot of ways for fans to contact their creators and give feedback, and And those guys pay attention to some degree, but at the same time, I think they have to, you know, they have a filter too that they have to run it through, so not to be clouded by.
Did you guys ever read that What the thing that came out?
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had a thing in there that was like.
I don't know if anyone can hear what's going on.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you read that What the issue that came out a while ago by Brian Michael Bendis and whoever. Because one of the things in there, they had like What If, they had message boards back in like Kirby's day and different eras. Which
it's funny that
I remember that. That was pretty funny. It was kind of like, you know, what are you thinking?
Because there were actually some story ideas in that book from people on his message board that like contributed ideas or just threw them out there because he started the thread and said, okay, what would you want to see in a What the issue? And there were some that made it into the book, which just gives you an idea of, you know, the kind of connection now that the creators have with the fans, or at least the ones that are online.
Well, they're out there, but I think that if a creator wants to be accessible, they can make themselves very accessible, and that's a cool thing. If they don't want to be accessible, they don't have to be. And you know, it just depends on how much they want to throw themselves out on the internet these days. So it's the options there, and I think that a lot of the creators like the accessibility that's built up there. Moving on, and this is one that I think that everyone can agree has greatly changed comics and the industry, and that is the death of the spinner rack. New comic fans
indie
are almost
spinner
rack will never die.
All right,
but new comic fans are almost forced to go to local comic shops as the drugstore spinner rack becomes a thing of the past. It's actually kind of funny. I was at Borders today, and lo and behold, I was walking through there, and they had a spinner rack.
Yeah, I've seen a few of them in Chicago have spinner racks.
Next to their giant aisle of trade paperbacks.
Yes. Yeah. But I think, you know, it's not just the death of the spinner rack that's being talked. You know,
it's the distribution.
It's the distribution.
Direct market has changed. You know,
whenever they yanked comic books out of the liquor stores, the industry started to die.
And Bob couldn't get his 40-ounce in a flash.
Yeah.
Hey, you know. Don't pick on my liquor stores in California. When I was a kid, I actually, because my family's from here, I remember coming to Chicago when I was probably about 12 years old, and I was at my aunt's house, and I wanted to go get some comics, and I asked my aunt, where's the liquor store? And she was, like, taken aback. She ended up sending me to, like, a White Hen. After I explained it, I ended up at a White Hen getting my, fix of Teen Titans.
Well,
I want a spinner rack, by the way.
One?
I want one.
Oh,
that's
wow.
The one thing that I would love to have. I would love to have a spinner rack in my comics room.
Steal one from Borders.
Yeah, I know.
Just run in there and run out and
find one somewhere.
Say you bought it someplace else.
Well, Tom or Sal, either one of you guys, was your first experience
absolutely
buying comics in a convenience store off of a spinner rack?
The first time my parents bought me a comic book from that. They used to have them like in Green Bay, they used to have them like in a Shopko. They'd
Piggly
have like
Wiggly.
A big, yeah. They'd just
the
have one.
Farm and Fleet.
The first time anyone bought me a comic, I got like a huge like box of comics, so I didn't pay for those. But the first time I remember my parents ever buying me any, it was just off
I'm
one of those.
I'm probably just old enough to remember spinner racks being in the Hucks, is what we had in Southern Illinois. It was basically the 7-Eleven version down
there.
Go
Huck yourself. Sorry, I had to say it.
I grew up within a block of a 7-Eleven and another. It was strange because there were these two little sort of, well, they weren't really convenience stores at the time. One was a pharmacy and one was a 7-Eleven. Mm-hmm. And they both had spinner racks. And it was funny because they would carry different books. So I'd go to both of them and it was, you know, it's like some months there'd be really good stuff at 7-Eleven and really crappy stuff at the, you know, at the pharmacy, and other months it would be, you know, flip-flop. But, yeah, that's where I started buying them. And then I think the first comic shop that opened by me was, like, within, you know, riding distance on my bike when 25 years ago now, mm-hmm. I think it was. Yeah, when I was about 10 or 11. No.
My first
maybe a little
comic
older
book
than
that. Purchase that I remember was in a comic shop. Wow. It was a comic shop and baseball card shop. It was a specialty store.
I remember when the first comic shop opened that I knew about it. And I had gone, you know, on special things. There were used bookstores, you know, that you could get, like, some old comics for, you know, a nickel or a dime or whatever. But there were no actual comic shops like Dark Tower here in existence. I remember I was probably about 15 when the first comic shop opened near my house, and I started going there instead of, but, you know, you had a circuit, like you were saying, Sal, that, you know, you had, like, the drugstore had some right. things, the 7-Eleven another. I had, like, three or four different places, and when the 7-Eleven first opened near us, you know, that was one, and then there was the, you know, one, you know, there were, like, three places, and you'd go to them, because if you wanted to get that continued, the next issue, some months, and it was just random, you know.
Yeah, it was like who's buying,
you know, maybe Spider-Man would come to 7-Eleven this month, and maybe it wouldn't, you know.
Yeah,
and it's like,
yeah.
If you didn't go to all the places, you just didn't get
Bruce Rosenberger did a whole show on this and what it was like to track down these comics. And it may have been involved with Rick Gordon's podcast, but, you know, just the treks that they would have to go on from almost from town to town, scouring these drugstores to find.
Sleeping in mm-hmm. fields.
Well, Rick and I did talk about that, I think, on episode. Five or six of his.
Oh, Pop Cult Online.
Pop Cult Online.
Yeah, which if you want to hear more of Bob, you can check out the Pop Cult Online with Rick Gordon. You did two episodes with him talking about.
Two, and then the third one, we were talking about Spider-Man with various people, and the second part of that should be coming out anytime.
All right. I do remember, I didn't mean to say, but there was just a memory that came back to me right now. Was like the first.
Tell us.
You know, collectible or old comic that I bought. It was, you know, because there wasn't comic shops or anything, so it was just the new stuff that was coming out. And then I remember this little comic shop opened, and like the first collectible book that I ever bought was Invaders number one. I got it for like $7. I think, at the time, it was like, you know, it was a lot of money for me, you know, $7 for a comic book, but I wish I still had it.
The first comic that had another price put on the outside.
Yeah, it was.
Not memorizing the price guy, but I'm thinking Vader's number one is probably not much more than $7 now.
Probably not. I don't know.
I just love
the Invaders and
I tell you what, Sal, I'm gonna find an Invader.
Find
number
me an
one
Invader.
For
cool.
You,
so. That would be cool. I have no idea what comics are worth ever. I don't pay attention
so,
to
well,
what
the,
any
the,
of them
the,
are worth. Or
we talked about it last week's Friday episode. We even mentioned Bob. It's like we as fans. Have realized that the comics that we own are not worth anything more than really the paper they're printed on and the nostalgia factor. And we talked about you, and it's like Bob is a collector who has comics that are worth stuff, and they're investment.
Not investments, though. I mean, because I look at my books, I don't look at them as investments. And that's whenever I use someone, so, you know, if I tell somebody, you know, that I work with or something that I, you know, if I get to know them and I say, hey, you know, I collect comics. One of the first things out of their mouth is, wow, what are they worth? You know, and it's like, essentially, I buy them not as an investment. That's what I see wrong with some of this. Mm-hmm. You know, like that whole CGC, you know, getting comics slabbed, right? I think that is so wrong that I just can't even, you know, go into that so much, but
You're a fan and a reader first.
Right.
And you,
yeah, I collect them because I have that collector gene where I want to have the complete set. But, you know, I have my Brave and Bold number 28, and it's framed, and it's up on the wall.
Whoa.
Well, as well as Brave and Bold 29 and 30 and Justice League 1 through 7. I have all the Justice League, but, I mean, those I have up.
You have a complete run of Justice League.
Oh, yeah.
All.
A complete run.
Wow. Lord. Even Justice League Detroit?
I do indeed have Justice League Detroit.
I would ask you to tell your friends about the Around Comics podcast, but let's face it, your friends are a little bit on the two-dimensional side, aren't they?
All right, guys, let's move on. The next topic I wanted to touch on was global influence. And I think probably 40 years ago, American comics were very American. And now, and really for the last...
Weren't they fighting the Nazis?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
The only foreigner you saw in a comic was some, he was a Nazi or...
A fang-tooth Japanese.
Yeah,
or,
really
Superman's
very racially inappropriate.
Superman's the ultimate foreigner.
But now we have the influence of British writers. We have manga is definitely making influences in Western comics. But, you know, talk about, and we've talked about manga before. And I think it is definitely making an influence here. But I think for traditional comic fans, the biggest change has been the influence of British writers more than anything else. You look at Alan Moore, Warren Ellis, Grant Grant Morrison. You know, how has that changed the comics landscape in the last 35 years?
They've made it snooty. No.
It definitely brought a different feel to comics.
Well, I feel that for whatever reason, they definitely seem more educated when it comes to literature than Americans. And I think just,
you culturally,
know, culturally, just... it's literature is a much bigger part of their upbringing and
there's a lot more literary references and a lot of that foundation in the writing. You know, but, you know, I'll bounce it to Bob here. Do you remember the beginnings of the British invasion of comic books?
Yeah, I mean,
to some extent, I mean, the first that I remember of it, before Vertigo, because Swamp Thing, you know, with Alan Moore, that's when I first started becoming aware of it. And then when Vertigo started, you know, that was certainly a big phase. But around before then, probably, there was a Eagle Comics. They used to reprint from 2000 AD Judge Dredd and Slain and Rogue Trooper. There was a whole bunch of different series from the UK that they would put. And Alan Moore actually wrote a lot of that stuff, too. So that was my first exposure to kind of the British invasion. And to some extent, I think that the comics world prior to that was relatively insular with, you know, whoever either was from New York or was willing to move to New York. You know,
to be in,
pretty
to be
much,
in the bullpen.
Yeah, that was pretty much was. Who wrote the comics. And there were fewer variety of writers back then also. And that just was the very first noticeable thing where they really opened it up. Also back then, I remember there were some import albums. So back in the 80s, I remember Mobius. There was a Marvel shone a spotlight on him, and there were some Spanish creators. There were also Asterix and Obelix from Italy, I believe. And I would pick up those things when I could, various places, and that was pretty interesting. And it was just different because there's certainly a very different style, as you said, Sal, to some of the different cultural influences, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think that we're getting ready to see that again on the art side. We talked with Ivan Brandon last week, and I think that we're on the cusp of seeing an influx of South American and Spanish artists that are coming into the comic industry kind of almost through the back door, through alternative press, through, you know, Image creator-owned titles. And I think that we're going to see a whole new influx of, you know, instead of writers now, on more of the art side.
It's certainly much easier, you know, like Bob was saying, you know, it used to be whoever lived in New York or was willing to move there. But now with the digital age of producing comics, it's, you know, there are plenty of creators, plenty of artists that live outside of the country that write, you know, comics here and that are published, and it's so much easier for them to do that now.
There's a lot of West Coast writers. You know, I think Brubaker, Rucka, and Bendis all live in the Pacific Northwest,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have, you
hippies.
Know, well, they like the lifestyle out there, but they're able to write comics.
But as far as the British thing, I mean, I just think they brought a certain maybe sophistication or a different level of sophistication to a lot of the characters and storylines. So
there was certainly an intricacy to, you know, putting the story together and certain elements that were not just a common, you know,
the superhero
sort of
cliche,
beats some other superhero,
right, right.
Fights him a little bit, and then realizes they're both on the same side, then they go tackle the bad guy together. I mean, that was a formula that had been going on
for a while.
Yeah,
added a deeper layer,
right.
to the storytelling.
The 80s was the real turnaround on that.
Sure.
But.
Yeah. Well, let's flip over a little bit more to the technical side, and I think this can go, you know, not just from the printing side, but, you know, how comics are made. You know, in the last, you know, probably 15 years, we've gone from the traditional art board, ink, color, and then, you know, the traditional key lines. You know, I'm in, you know, graphic design, and so I understand how printing has changed. We've gone to almost, we're starting to see completely digital comics now. We're seeing how pencilers will pencil, and then they'll scan, and they'll digitally ink and digitally color. And then we're seeing different printing processes of how paper quality and printing quality and paper grades have changed. You know, the actual quality of comic books on the shelves now compared to what they were, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago is drastically different.
That's true. I personally would not mind having poorer quality paper and lower prices. You know, I see a lot of times they're talking about the reason comics cost $3 or $4 a piece is because of the paper. And for me, if it meant knocking the price down a buck, I buy old comics. They're 40 years old, and they're printed on the cheapest, cruddiest pulp paper, and they're still...
Well, I'll tell you a little secret there, and I'll probably get rebuffed by this, but paper is dealt in volume. And if the majority of the paper that's being produced is a higher quality paper, it's not that much more expensive. So I don't know how much truth to that. There's some truth. I mean, printing on newsprint as opposed to, you know, whatever paper grade that they're printing a majority of these comics in, it's not that much of a difference cost-wise. But what I see is the cover stock is different. You're dealing with, you know the glossy coated covers, and you know there is a production value that I think that especially the American consumer has come to expect in comics that is different than what it used to be.
Well, interestingly, I think, you know, your American consumer that expects the high quality is the, you know, one of, you know, 15 or 20,000, you know, hardcore comic collectors who come into the comic shops, and, you know, going to a cheaper price point is what's going to maybe be the only thing that's going to get more people reading comics. Because I was in Japan a couple of years ago. You go anywhere, and it's a different culture, right? But they have the mangas that are printed on the cheapest paper in the world, and you can buy something that's, you know, about a half an inch thick with, you know, a couple of hundred pages, and it's about, you know, with the conversion to U.S. currency, it's like $2.50 or $3 or something. And they're not made to be kept forever. And I look at, you know, I don't know if it's a topic we're going to hit later, but I'll trump it here, you know, buying value of the dollar today versus when I was a kid. You know, when I started reading comics, they were 15 cents. And when I was 10 or 11 years old, I could wash my dad's car and he'd give me, you know, a buck or two. You know, I'd, you know, do stuff. I'd do yard work or, you know, whatever it was that I did. I'd wash the car, do that. And my dad would give me a couple of bucks. I'd have $2 at the end of the week from doing my chores.
It's 20 comics.
Right, exactly. You know, I could go out with that $2 and I could buy a bunch of comic books, you know, as many pretty much as I wanted in that week, and some candy bars and all that kind of stuff. You know, and a candy bar back then was, you know, I forget, like a nickel or a dime, and a comic book was 15 cents.
I ain't giving no kid 60 bucks to wash
exactly,
the car.
Exactly.
These
you
days.
Know, to buy those same things, if my 15-year-old wanted to do that, I mean, he would have, you know, I'd have to give him like 30 or 40 bucks for doing that. And it has far outpaced the, you know, cost
of
living.
I think
know.
A lot of, and Tom, you're going to say what I'm going to say.
I think it's, I don't know if we're going to say the same thing. I'm going to say that Bob's completely wrong. No, I'm kidding. What I was going to say is this kind of goes back to the production quality. Is there's such a homogenous sense of what sort of quality I think comic fans want. Like, the big two sort of set the pace, and everyone else sort of makes their books based on that because they think that everyone wants a 22-page story with paper of that quality. But then you see things like Image with their, like, slimline, like, $1.99 thing, which I think is a really interesting idea, because I think there is room for various qualities, various prices, stuff that we don't see right now in the comics industry.
Well, I think a couple of things that we're also ignoring is, one, creator, you know, rights, and the cost that you have to pay people to write.
They're not getting paid in rice anymore.
Well, yeah. I mean,
have
that's
Roy
a huge...
Thomas write everything. He loves it.
I mean, that's a huge, you know, difference between comics that were 15 cents and comics today, is that the creators are actually getting paid a livable wage for what they're doing. And secondly, the marketing aspect and what the market will bear, you know, comics are what they are because we're willing to pay for it.
And that's my point, is that it's not the 10-year-old kid washing the car and mowing the grass, it's buying comics. It's these 30-year-old fools or, you know, 44-year-old fools like us that...
Are you calling our guest a fool?
Yeah. 27-year-old
just as much of a fool as I am because he's willing to go out and spend, you know, $25 or $40 or $60 a week for these. And the market is...
Well, I mean, that's
150.
That's part of the everything. Whole. That's part of the whole. That's part of the whole aging thing, though. Too is sort of as you get older, your idea of what value is changes too. Like certain books I read now, I get immediately pissed off when I'm done reading it because I think, well, damn it, that was $3, and why did I, you know, why did I read that?
But it's not that every book has to be in a cheaper format, or you know. Because
just
I look
variety.
At it as, where are you going to get the comic fan that's going to be the 30-year-old comic fan 20 years from now if you make comics totally inaccessible to kids? And here's an example. I'm at work this week here with a bunch of people, and you know I saw Superman, and I thought it was really good. I asked you guys, and you all saw Superman probably. You know, I don't know if Rios ever went and saw
Chris
Superman.
Chris didn't.
But, you know, I asked people if they saw Superman, and they're like, no, not really, you know. But you ask them if they saw or want to see Pirates of the Caribbean, which is just as, you know, goofy and silly, but it's not a comic book, and all of them want to see that.
It's a carnival ride at Disney. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And
it's Johnny.
It's
Tom Quater's coat.
It's very interesting because you have, you know, a difference there. And, you know, if you don't have kids getting into comics now... What's going to happen? You know, it's just, you know,
well,
you're
I think that that's
decreasing
part group. Of the, you know, mainstream DC Marvel, you know, part of their problem is trying to compete with so much else. You know, it, when we were kids or, you know, even before that, and comics sold, you know, in huge numbers compared to today, there weren't the video games and
right.
the DVDs and the music choices and the movie choices that there are today that kids are... I don't want to say distracted by, but
the
they have the choices.
Music.
That, you know, well, no, I'm just
saying. Rap.
And if you're Marvel or DC, you're looking at it from that perspective of how are we trying to compete. My honest belief is that Marvel or DC Comics is not trying to sell to new readers. That is not their goal anymore.
I agree with you
100%. I don't think they can compete. I don't think that they have a product that they can compete with so many other things and still make any money doing it and stay alive. I think if Marvel tomorrow decided we're going to do everything we can to try and market comics to the masses and sell and try and sell millions of copies of comics, however we could, they would go out of business because those comics would probably offend the majority of the hardcore comic book fans and, you know, and what are bought now on a daily basis.
And we'll get into this next week, but big chunk of Marvel's pie, just like DC, is licensing. And
sure.
You know, I don't want to say they don't care about comic sales,
but they don't care about comic sales.
Comic sales are such a small part of their corporate structure
sure.
that it's much more about licensing.
Statue
than
sales.
Right. Yeah.
That's where big money in HeroClix.
And HeroClix.
No, they do care more about the media, the multimedia properties that they can get out there. I agree with you. They use the comics more as a kind of R&D wing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of like
yeah.
a lost leader to some extent. But, you know, I'm not trying to say that they should make some drastic change and, you know, go over to, you know, completely changing their line
yeah.
to, you know, cheaper paper and, you know, that, but I'm just saying, on an entry level book like Marvel Adventures, which I applaud Marvel on Marvel Adventures because those Avengers and Spider-Man mm-hmm. and FF books, they're
very
good,
accessible,
done in one.
Yeah.
They're very accessible. They're characters that the kids are familiar with from movies and games and things like that. But you know, couldn't they try a little harder to put that out at like $1.50 or something instead of it being $3.
$1.99, like
you know?
A slim
well,
line.
I think they have,
or, you know, or whatever. And it's just like it's one or two books. It's not like they're doing it with their whole line just to, you know, get it. And also, if, you know, and again, I know there's corporate reasons for this, but, you know, cross-marketing it. You know, when you go to see Superman, how come Justice League Adventures and Batman Strikes and stuff aren't being cross-promoted?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have all these commercials in front of a movie anyway.
We've talked about
the rights to the Martian Manhunter movie.
We've talked about that before, and it, you know, just sort of an interesting little story. I have a friend of mine who never has read a comic book in his life, never had any interest in it, went and saw Sin City, the movie. When it came out on DVD, he bought the special edition that came with the digest-sized graphic novel. And now he's interested. He read it, and he loved it, and now he's interested in comics. And it was a a simple thing that didn't cost him anything to throw that in there. It was just, you know, smart of them to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you don't see it nearly as much as you would think, you know.
But don't you see the independent or alternative press companies trying to cross-promote more than you do Marvel or DC?
Well, I guess they have to. I mean, they're sure. desperate, so they have to, and that's part of the problem, is Marvel and DC are sort of gluttonous, and they are slow-moving. You know, it's like you're driving a Porsche, you're driving a bus, which one turns, makes turns
this
quicker?
This month they just released the Newsarama just had the diamond sales numbers, and Marvel and DC have the biggest share that they've had.
Ever.
Like the total, yeah.
They must be doing something right. A lot of that's spurned by Civil War.
And I think that's crisis. Part of the problem is that they're getting mixed messages from all their marketing efforts. You know, it's like they don't know what the right direction is, so they test things out here and there. You know, we were talking about accessible comics for kids or making them accessible. You know, like Runaways, extremely popular book, perfect for teens, you know, that wanted to read comics. And they did, you know, come out with a small digest. Uh-huh. They've reprinted those in cheaper formats and that kind of thing. So they've tried to make, you know, headway into some things, but I think they're so afraid of making a mistake and, you know, really, you know, sort of biting the hand that feeds them that they aren't willing to, you know, take chances.
It's okay, I'm the hand that feeds them, and I love comics, and I like where they're positioned right now. But that's from a very, very selfish, self-centered comic
you
fan.
Bastard.
Give them all the finger.
What?
Well, I do like the fact that now a lot of the action figures that they put out, you know, these Marvel Legends,
have a comic with them.
They have a comic with them. The new Superman line that you see at Target or Walmart, and Batman lines, they have a comic included in them. And I think that's a good place to start. I mean, it's going to expose a kid that gets the figure to a comic book story. Just hopefully it'll be.
Well, how many kids are going to? But also, how many kids are going to buy the $15 Mr. Sinister?
Well,
they won't, but their parents will.
When you,
yeah.
If there are any left at the Walmart after the guys who resell them on eBay
snatch them all up and destroy them.
You know, they're only like $7 there.
$7.
So.
Well, I tell you, let's move ahead here. We talked about independent and alternative, and that is definitely something that in the last 35 years has changed. Come into the scene and changed again, and that's the rise and growth of the independent comic scene. Once again, we'll start with Bob. You know, whenever you started collecting or reading, I don't even think it was collecting at that point, but it was, you know, it was Marvel, then it was a little bit of DC, I'm sure, but
yep.
When did independent comics or even the thought of something that wasn't Marvel or DC get onto your radar as a comic reader?
Probably around when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that whole black and white boom, there were a lot of them were far worse than others, but there was a lot of interesting stuff coming out from different publishers. And, you know, as I mentioned before, the British reprints, those started coming out. And really, I think where it hit its stride was when First Comics and Eclipse Comics, but they were all, for the most part, still in that superhero genre, which now what I like about a lot of the independents is you're in a whole bunch of different genres. So, you know, just so you don't have to do it, I'll mention Queen and Country. Get the obligatory around comics.
We really need to get paid by Greg.
But, I mean, you have that kind of book. You'll have the horror books. You have Western books. You have, you know,
slice of life
kind of books. You know, you're like, I was just at the Museum of Contemporary Art today here in Chicago. They had the Chris Ware exhibit, and, you know, things like Acme Novelty Library and Jimmy Corrigan, you know, those kind of things. You know, there's a whole bunch of different types now in independent comics, which interestingly, you know, when you talk about things that would appeal to people outside of comics, especially adults, that's the kind of stuff. You know, your adult is probably not going to come in and pick up, you know, one of these issues of Moon Knight that's coming out and get really excited about that. But I think that, you know, someone could pick up Fables or DMZ or a lot of the Vertigo mm-hmm. stuff or a lot of these independent books that are out and actually get that and get something out of it, like your friend Sal, who read that Sin mm-hmm. City, you know, book. And then, you know, that's the kind of thing that would appeal to that adult collector.
What do you think that it was? A lot of kids in the 60s and 70s that grew up reading comic books got turned on to art. Then these kids end up going to art school, and that's where you see a lot of these art house books that started coming out in the 70s and 80s, where you had, you know, guys that grew up being artists, and then they get into this whole art community, and they had grown up loving sequential art and saw that as a really a viable art form, and that's how they express themselves. That's where you get, you know, the Chris Wares and Dan Klaus and
well, you know, the thing that's interesting to me, and I was thinking about this earlier, is that, you know, when Underground Comics with an X first came out, I mean, that was very, you know, underground and very you know, they were almost like protest comics to some degree. I mean, the era, the 60s.
They were very counterculture.
And Vietnam. And I look at, you know, I was kind of thinking today, it's like, where are those comics today? How come we don't see that? I mean, there's more independent comics out today than ever before. But less, you know, it's like more people are trying to, like, write a comic that'll turn into a TV show or a movie mm-hmm. than write a comic that they're trying to say anything about or, you know, say something.
Probably DMZ is probably the only one that comes to my mind.
There's easier ways for you now to, if you are counterculture, I think. There's a huge internet society of people making their own little movies, well, and their own things, like, cost-effective-wise.
Get Your War On? There was no such thing
as a video camera, right? Mm-hmm. In that day. So, I mean, when someone wanted to express themselves, especially if they wanted to express themselves visually, you know, it wasn't easy for someone to go out and get a film camera and film stock and all these kind of things. You know, they could draw a comic book and get mm-hmm. a few thousand printed up and sell them out of head shops or whatever, you know. But now you've got digital cameras and the internet, as Tom mm-hmm. mentioned, and, you know, you can get a video camera for a couple of $100.
Put it on YouTube.
You know, and you can get it on YouTube and, yeah, thousands upon thousands. More people will download... whatever kind of nonsense someone puts on YouTube, then we'll buy any comic
book that
comes out. Yeah, but, I mean, you see the hit rate on things.
Sure. Well, maybe it's stuff like webcomics. Maybe that's where the counterculture is, as opposed to a lot of the
maybe you're just not cool enough to know where the comic
where the real underground is.
Well, you say in music, too.
Maybe.
Yeah, Steve Earle is a incredibly active political singer-songwriter, and that's one of his calls to action is, where are the protest songs? And you see that in comics. Where's the counterculture in any facet of the entertainment industry, whether it be movie or music or, comic books?
We just don't know where it is.
Well, you know, the online comics, I think we are old because, you know, to some extent, because my 15-year-old son, I mean, I work in computers. I sit and I look at a computer screen all day long. The last thing I want to do is sit and read comics on the computer. Mm-hmm. I don't like web comics, you know, I don't. But my 15-year-old son, he will sit, you know, it's summer now, you know, he'll sit all day long. He's got like about 20 or 30 different web comics that he's got bookmarked, and he will sit and read these web comics, and he's always searching for...
Kick that kid out of the house and make him play baseball. Yeah, what are you doing?
No, put him in the basement, give him some real comics.
Well, he does, you know,
sit and read this.
He's a fortunate child, you know.
Oh, yeah.
He pretty much reads about 40 different titles a month because they're just there. I mean, I've got them all. I let him read them.
I'm moving
full,
in.
You know.
And all right,
tear
guys.
Falls from my eye.
One thing that we kind of have to go over, and we started off the show talking about it, and that is writing for the trade. Maybe not even writing for the trade, but trades in general. You know, obviously when Bob started reading, you couldn't go and buy a collection of, you know, Amazing Spider-Man 1-6. That wasn't an option. How much has the trade market changed comic books? And we'll start off with Bob.
I think to some extent that the trade market will do potential damage to new issue sales. And I'm seeing the industry should probably just move into just publishing them directly as
straight to trade.
Straight trade, you know, graphic novels, real great graphic novels as opposed to collections, because how many of these series do you hear about that just have terrible circulation
monthly
have
sales.
Really good buzz, and when you talk to people, they say, well, I'm waiting for the trade. I'm waiting for six issues to
Exterminators.
Come out. Exterminator. I bought the trade of Exterminator.
How'd you like that, by the way?
I didn't get it yet. I mean, is the trade out? It hasn't shipped to me.
We're going to edit that, and we're going to make it that Bob says.
Yes, it was the greatest comic ever.
I enjoyed it.
It was the greatest comic since Amazing Spider-Man 88.
I hear really good things about it, and I'm looking forward. I have ordered the trade from DCBS, and when it comes out, I'll get it, and I'll read it. You know, I read a lot of the, especially Vertigo stuff, seems to
lend itself to that
exactly
format.
Lend itself to that format, and I read a lot of Vertigo stuff in trade form. I read Preacher in trades. I read Fables and 100 Bullets and
but I think the reason that you don't see so much of that is the same reason that, you know, like movie, you know, production companies put out four, you know, versions of the same DVD because people buy them. You know, it's like how many different
versions of Watchmen do you own?
Three.
Okay. And he's paying me to do my own version.
Yes. Yeah,
I
own the original issues, I own the trade, and then I own the absolute edition.
I only own two. I own the graffiti one, which is essentially identical to the absolute edition,
right,
but not as big, and I have the original issues. I have like five versions of Kingdom Come, though.
Wow. I own issue number one, and I'm waiting for the really, really... really absolute.
The final absolute.
Yeah, I've been like 10 years from
the
now.
The pen ultimate, yeah, ultimate, this is it, done.
I don't buy any books.
Absolute.
But I just, it's and we talked about this earlier, you know, that collector mentality. It's like, I want the single issues because I want to read it now, but then they come out with a trade version. It's like, well, you know, I'll get that. And especially then they come out with an absolute edition, and it's, well, it's got extra stuff in it. And,
I tend to get just either or. And, you know, the thing is, if I don't get into something early on, like Walking Dead, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I got into Walking Dead when Comic Geek Speak was pushing it, right, you know, as their book of the month. And I picked it up in trade, and I read it. But since I am a collector, I'm kind of like a completist. And if I can't get all the issues, and, you know, it's impossible to find those. And it's kind of like, it's a good series, but it's not something that I'm going to go out and spend hundreds of dollars trying to track down all the issues. So I just made the decision, well, I can't get all the issues in monthly format, so I'm just going to collect it in trade format. And the same thing with Fables. I got into Fables when they did it as a Book of the Month club, and getting all the back issues would be tremendously more expensive. I look at those things as, you know, again, it's not like they're, my personal opinion, it's not like they're ever going to be worth a tremendous amount of money. You know.
But for every guy like you, there's a guy out there that will, you know, and that will go back and get those single issues, and then there's guys that, you know what I mean?
Well,
so
when
it's
series
the different
is going, you know, look at Sandman. I mean, Sandman ended years ago. What's the market like for back issues of Sandman now? They used to go for big bucks when Sandman was ongoing, but once people forget about it and it's just in trades, you know, Fables, the back issue market, and it'll dry up 5-6 years after they stop publishing when it hits the end
of
the series.
It's interesting because every time I see Marvel coming out with a miniseries I want to get, like Agents of Atlas, I just think, well, I'll just
the trade
will come out the day that the last issue comes out.
Well, you know, like, probably a couple months down the line. But one thing for me is that, you know, I've always been a Marvel guy, and I love the diversity that independent comics offer me. And I've never been a hardcore DC follower. But, you know, Tom, through his infinite knowledge and wisdom, has been trying to guide me through some DC stuff. And I'm not going to go back and buy individual issues of JSA or Flash or, you know, whatever he says is good. You know, D-Man is a guy on the forum that's told me, hey, these are some great Wonder Woman trades to go and check out what the real character of Wonder Woman is, which is someone that's never interested me. Now the trade paperback market allows me to go, and I bought two trades of Geoff Johns' Flash run, and you know what? I liked them. I didn't have to go and, you know, pick and, I mean, yeah, and scratch for those.
That's a great thing, and I think I mentioned this in the forum. One of the weird things I think with the trade market almost is there's all this stuff that is old that you can't get in trade, but you can get everything that comes out now in trade. I think it would be cool if some of these companies focused on to wait for the essentials to get something like Kraven's Last Hunt.
This is a plea to Marvel. I'm just starting to realize how innovative Steranko was as an artist, and I really want color versions of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Was a trade. I have it.
They did trade it?
Yeah, a lot, but
I can't find it anywhere.
It's out of print, but they did at some point trade
it. Put
it
back in
print,
because that's one that, you know, I want, now that, you know, not just because of the podcast, but just because of my heightened interest as a comic book fan, I really want to go back and investigate some of these classic old series. And not in black and white, and I know that they do that for an affordability standpoint, but I want, you know, Steranko loses a lot in black and white.
I agree with you, Chris. Now, I'll make a point here, though. What you're talking about is taking storylines that were in the original comics and reprinting them in trade, and I think that's a great thing to do when you take classic definitive stuff, but that is absolutely different than the writing for the trade. When you look at it, you know, when we talked back when I started reading comics, and I could read a set of Spider-Man comics, and they told an overall story, but each issue told a complete useful story that I could get something out of. I pick up Moon Knight number 1 and 2, and I can appreciate the fact that those are, you know, chapters 1 and 2 of a 6-issue story arc, but that is like pretty much incomprehensible.
What would you have thought 20 years ago if that Charlie Houston Moon Knight, if you would pick that up off the shelf?
I would have never picked up issue number 2.
Crazy,
and I would have never, I would have never come back to Moon Knight. I mean, but the thing is, especially, you know, like month to month, I mean, it's just, I don't get a satisfying chunk of story that stands by itself in a single issue of a lot of these books. But I'm not disagreeing the fact that I'm sure it's artfully told as a 6-issue story that if I read it all together as a trade, that's going to be great. But you know what? Let's just put that out as a single thing, because when I read it and then a month later I read the next one, you know, well, I personally, I read too many comics to,
being written for the trade, then just put the trade out.
Exactly. Okay. Now, you know, JSA, you know, I'm looking at the trades on the wall over here. Look at Black Reign trade. Mm-hmm. Those issues in that story stood by themselves as solid issues that you could have read any one of those individual issues and gotten something out of it when it came in. Now I can put the trade out, and you know, that's a longer story, but I mean, there was action and all that. It just wasn't,
I agree with you, but except on one point, I think we put too much emphasis on the writing for the trade. I don't know that it's so much that there's this ethos in any of these companies that, hey, you have to write 6-issue arcs, or you have to write 8-issue arcs, or whatever it is.
But they do.
No. But is that just a symptom of writing different types of stories and more complex stories that are not serialized, self-contained, simpler stories?
Even if there weren't trades, would writers still be writing stories?
I think to some degree.
Look at Watchmen. That was a limited series.
Mm-hmm.
When Watchmen came out as a 12-issue maxi series, I read that off the rack, as did you, mm-hmm. I believe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did not get to the end of Watchmen number 1, and I wasn't scratching my head and saying, what the hell just happened here? I mean, I got a decent piece of story.
Well, yeah, but you're talking about maybe the best writer ever in comics, and you want everyone to be able to write to that level.
Go to Camelot 3000, which, you know, I don't think Mike W. Barr is the greatest writer that ever wrote in comics. That was a 12-issue series, and, you know, take away the fact that it took him like 3 years to put out, you know, issue 12. I mean, when I read that series off the rack, when it came out, each issue told a satisfying chunk of story that was not incomprehensible in and of itself. And it was written as a...
But how many comics
series.
Today are the, you know... Obviously, well, the Moon Knight is one...
series, and, you know...
12.
Well, it's an ongoing.
Okay, went from 6 to 12.
I stopped
ongoing.
Getting it after
Well, that's
issue
one
two,
example,
so
but I mean, that's maybe the extreme. We're talking about both ends of the spectrum. I mean, you talk about the majority of books that come out, even if, I mean, I'll look at, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man.
Or Punisher Max.
I mean, anybody that writes, you know, I think the whole writing for the trade came up with Brian Bendis.
Yeah,
I think
that
sort of started with him. But you read those issues individually, and there's nothing.
Fun. Right. No, I agree with you. On Ultimate Spider-Man, he tells arcs, and Bendis is doing something right there, because I can read the monthly Ultimate Spider-Man book and get a satisfying piece of story out of each month of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not... I don't call that writing for the trade. Now, he might be packaging it into 4, 6, 8, or whatever kind of story arcs that ultimately will be traded, but that's going back to what Stan Lee was doing 30
sure.
years ago, or any of these other writers, because I can read. I read Ultimate Fantastic Four. I read Ultimate X-Men. I read
Well,
I
once
read
again,
a lot of those
I mean,
those
other than the Moon Knight, I mean, Moon Knight is an extreme example. I myself, I'm not bothered by it. I don't, and maybe it's just because I don't, I can appreciate the story for what it is while it's going. I don't need the instant gratification of that. And then not, I mean, I just personally, I don't necessarily need to have.
You're okay with
everything
it being
wrapped
in that
up.
Book. Not if every book was written like that, but for that title, you're okay
for that
with
title.
It.
I think that not every book is like that, though. I mean, I think that when somebody says writing for the trade as a pejorative. Right, that's the kind of one they're talking about. I don't
certainly,
think it's
but
universal.
That's been around for a longer than Moon Knight has. And my point was just
that's
I think
just the
we
one
put
that
a,
comes. To
I
mind.
Think we just put a lot of emphasis on that and use it as sort of a something to hang our hat on when we want to complain about.
Here's a point I wanted to make. It's people talk about writing for the trade as being a bad thing. I have come very accustomed to the 6-issue story, and I like it. I read Punisher Max every month, and all those are 5- and 6-issue stories. I really like that format.
I read that also.
I enjoy the format of, you know what?
I don't pay attention
for
to
the
it,
next
quite honestly.
Well, no. I can't
remember what I read last month. Most
but, well, I mean, that's sort of...
I like the idea of, you know what? I'm going to get 2 really good stories this year probably, and I'm going to find out about them, you know, 6 months at a time. So, you know, the idea of a writer saying, you know what? I'm going to do 12 issues on this series, and I'm either going to tell 1 or 2 stories, and I'm going to do it for a year, and I'm going to tell my story. I like that.
But I also think you can have a bad 6-issue story, too, just because
certainly.
6
sure.
or 12 issues isn't any sort of guarantee.
I don't
that
consider
it's gonna be
intriguing. Punisher Max written for the trade, though, because I read it monthly. And
but, yeah, exactly, but they're
but
all in, like, 6-issue
arcs. I understand
arcs.
That, but what I'm saying is that when I hear written for the trade mm-hmm. used in a negative fashion, it's typically attached to those series that are written in a clumsy
like
fashion where
it's not
giving you that
solid chunk of story on a monthly basis. A two-issue story and extend it over 6
I think
six
what
issues.
Bob's trying to say is, like, and I see what he means about Moon Knight. You read Moon Knight and you get to the last page of the issue and it's not the end.
There's nothing that compels you to buy issue number 2.
Well, you're hoping he was going to get out of the house.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to get out. I mean, it's like.
It's bad marketing to me, because any serialized thing that comes out on a monthly basis, if they're doing their job, in my opinion, they should leave you at the end of that issue with a desire to pick up the next issue.
See, you read
Man,
Fables.
I just think we're conditioned to that. I think that we're just. I mean, look at a book like Love and Rockets. There's no. Most of those issues, there had no, you know, some were self-contained, but that went on for years
See,
and weren't.
But you read something like Fables,
gratifying.
You read something
well, they
like
they were entertaining, but they weren't necessarily self-contained.
I didn't
stories
I
in
yeah,
any
not,
way.
I don't think they have to be self-contained. There has to be a satisfying chunk of story that moves the characters along, that tells you something.
Make it worth my $3.
Make it worth my $3. And Moon Knight, again, I don't want to harp on Moon Knight, but I mean, you're just sitting in a house like for an issue with a bunch of weird flashbacks and stuff.
I didn't get
that.
It's like with Fables.
Value.
You read Fables, and it makes sense in a trade. But you can read individual issues of Fables, and there's a beginning and an end.
Right.
There's also a beginning and an end to five sets of the stories that all fit together.
That's because Willingham's a hell of a writer.
Yeah, within those five stories. Right. But I don't pick up an issue of Fables, get to the end of it, and be like, oh, well, what? I don't, you
don't
know,
feel
like,
ripped
yeah.
off.
Yeah, I don't feel
okay,
like.
Okay, why The Last Man? Brian, yeah. And Ex Machina. Brian K. Vaughan has turned into really kind of, he and Kirkman are the king of the cliffhanger. They write these great single issues within arcs that, you know, it's almost like we were talking about at the very beginning about Spider-Man, is that each issue was entertaining unto its own, but you had this great lead-in into the next issue. And I think those two writers, maybe more than any other writers out there right now, are amazing at leading you into the next issue with a great hang at the end.
Well, I mean, it's a classic element of comic book storytelling. Like I said, I just think we're so preconditioned that anything outside of that we, you know, instantly reject for some reason. But, I mean, the Moon Knight, I can understand why people may not like it, and not to go back to necessarily that book, but... I think it would be interesting to see, you know, publishers come out with direct-to-trade editions. But I don't think you're going to see it because they can't afford to take the chance on...
It's a huge layout of
money and time and effort and what if it doesn't work? Where you can put out a couple issues or something, and then, you know, if it
fails, be surprised if sales tremendously drop off after the first one, and you just hear a lot of people are waiting for the trade, quote-unquote.
Well, that certainly happens, but then they just put out a press release that says they're canceling the book, and then there's a huge swell of fan support.
Spider-Girl.
And, you know, and
all right, guys, we can and probably will have an entire episode dedicated to writing to the trade. I want to move on here, and I want to talk about more about the publicity and how we as fans are buying comics now. Before we wrap up, I want to talk about previews, and I want to talk about the news outlets. So, Bob, talk to
The Ruination.
Yeah, The Ruination.
I don't see it as a ruination,
uninformed asshole.
Well, when I first started reading comics, you know, I could genuinely be surprised by something that happened. I read Spider-Man number 100 off the rack, and I don't think, I'm not going to call spoiler on something that happened 35 years ago.
Go ahead.
I haven't got to it.
Tom's putting his earplugs in.
Tom's putting his fingers in his ears over
when
here.
When Stacy died.
That was 121. in Spider-Man 100, he's trying to take a serum to cure himself of being Spider-Man, and he grows four extra arms. You read that last panel, and four extra arms sprout out of him, and he's really like a spider. He got his, you know,
it's a great hero click, by the way.
Yeah.
And, they're just going to reverse that.
You know, and they did reverse it a couple of two issues later, you know, he gets rid of them. But the interesting thing there was, boy, I was so floored when I turned the page and saw that happen. And I wanted to come back and buy that next issue and find out what happened the next month. And it totally surprised me.
You don't get that anymore?
And now you have to go out of your way to not have stuff ruined for you 3, 4, 5 months before it even comes out.
Here's a spoiler for Daredevil. So if you haven't read Daredevil in the last four issues, close your ears for a second. How far in advance did you know that Foggy Nelson was dead? And how much did that piss you off?
I had heard the rumors, but I didn't know it for a fact until I read
There's a difference between rumor and solicitation.
But they didn't solicit that Foggy was dead.
Yes, they did. I don't want to ruin this for you,
but the Civil War director's cut leaks who the Daredevil is that's running around dressed
you
as
are
Daredevil.
Crapping
so
me.
Don't look, and if you ever see it, don't look, because I know it will ruin for you, and I won't tell you
You're
who it is.
You're crapping me.
No, it does. It does. There's a thing
that's
where
terrible.
the Civil War
They've
director's cut.
They've got to get their solicitations under control.
It's not the solicitation. It's written on the script that they printed in, like, huge letters. Or so I saw.
Well,
I
but that
know,
could,
yeah.
But at the same time, they've done
D-Man, isn't it?
They've done that.
It's Human Fly now.
They've done that kind of thing to
Hal Jordan.
It's impossible to try and keep a secret. I mean, even if they didn't, even if it wasn't solicitations, something's, you know, you've seen it in movies and
it's not impossible because I killed a man
nearly,
10 years ago and no.
It's nearly impossible, but
sorry,
I think it does take effort on your part to not get you know, surprise or to not get spoiled by certain things. But, you know, a perfect example is like Fantastic Four or Ultimate Fantastic Four that came out this week. A great issue with some pretty
totally surprised.
Yeah, it's shocking, you know, some pretty surprising things.
Haven't read it yet.
No, no, I'm not saying anything in it.
Daredevil
great,
shows up.
But a fantastic issue, a top name writer and artist and book and everything else. I had no idea what was going on, that any of that was going to happen.
Yeah.
I guess it's it's all
it
a matter of how much
universally.
It,
and I'm not trying to say that. I mean, I personally, in many cases, I don't mind the spoilers. I don't get totally thrown off track by these things. I mean, I didn't, you know.
I don't know. I said that Foggy Nelson thing, and you had a vein pop out of your head.
I knew that.
What?
I didn't.
I know who the
put my fingers
is.
In my ears and go la la la, you know, before any time talked about the Superman movie before it came out. I mean, I didn't really care. I mean, I'll go see a preview for a movie or things like that. I'm just pointing it out since the topic here was what's different now than 35 years ago. That's absolutely different than 35 years ago because there was zero chance. It's Stamp Comic Shop
owners. They're the ones that
there was zero chance of that stuff previews. Happening.
It's podcast.
Many years ago, and even 20 years ago, you know, there was previews. Mm. I mean, previews has been around since the early
80s. But not everybody bought it and read it
ordered previews would be, you know, Justice League number 220 is coming out. Do you want to order it? It didn't have an entire blurb.
But
Justice
League is still coming
out. What's going on in the issue with a picture
of
the cover.
It's a double-edged sword that they, you know, on one end there's so much competition
they have to
try and entice you to buy the books because there's so many more books on the shelf. But at the other, you know, you take the risk of.
And how could you not?
For me, it's like, okay, so even though I knew Foggy Nelson was going to die, in the back of my head, I didn't go into that book and enjoy it any less.
It didn't give me the oh shit moment that it should have.
Yeah. But you didn't know exactly who was going to shiv him in the jail.
He got
shivved. Yeah, I guess I look at it a little differently. Is that I don't, you know, until it happens, and even when it does, sometimes. I mean, it's a comic book. It's I mean, I'm not 12 anymore. I don't. You know, it's like I don't.
No, I'm 33, and I take it much more seriously than I did when I was 12.
I suppose so. I guess I just don't. I guess I just don't care as much about it. I mean, it's like it's to me. I like that story, and it didn't matter to me that I knew going into it that he was going to die because I still didn't believe it.
Well,
until I actually saw his funeral, and maybe I still don't believe it. You know
maybe
what I mean?
What I'd like to see is a few more red herrings out there, just you know, to give me that
to give you the illusion of
they have done that a couple of times, and I think that's good. I mean, bottom line is I don't get tremendously upset by spoilers, but you know, it basically is one of the big things now.
That's different.
You know, whether it bothers you or not, you know, if you're a fan of comics now, you have to pretty much go out of your way
to not
have things spoiled.
We crave information.
It's you know, opposite ends of the spectrum. And I guess the same thing is true, you know, about all our life. So, you know, even, you know, back in the 60s, I mean, Rock Hudson was gay and no one knew Rock Hudson
spoilers.
Was...
Spoilers! Jesus, yeah. I didn't know
but
that.
But I mean... People kept that secret. Now it's like, you know, Britney Spears can't put her kid in the car without a car seat, without it being on the front page of every newspaper 6 hours later. You know, so
Hudson's
I think the society has changed somewhat in comics.
I know you watch
just
Giant. You never
that.
Would imagine.
All right, guys.
Sorry, Bob.
Guys, we okay. As
the
I
Rock
thought, as I thought was going to happen with this episode, we're talking about Thomas.
Tom
is
really
shattered
upset by this
here.
Rock Hudson thing.
They're actually going to tell me Liberace's gay.
I was going to say, don't tell me.
Why
about
is everyone
Dean.
Laughing so hard?
As I thought was going to happen funny, with Tom. This episode, we've got 35 years of comic books that we can talk about, and we could probably make this a 12-hour podcast. But
well, we're getting there.
We got to wrap this up. Okay. We're gonna wrap this up with a final thought. I'm gonna start with Bob. Final thought: the single most important change, or event, or series in the last 35 years. Go.
Crisis on Infinite Earths when they got rid of the parallel universes at DC.
Post-crisis, pre-crisis. Tom.
When they stopped having letter columns all the time in comics for a while, now they brought them back.
All right.
Which makes the difference. I love books with letters, columns.
Okay. So. The disappearance and reappearance of letter columns.
Yeah.
Goofball.
That's not even really an answer that I gave. That's the only thing I could think of.
Sal, biggest event or change?
Teenage
or
Mutant
work?
Ninja Turtles. I think it showed the industry that.
God damn it! I should have said that.
That something besides the norm could really be successful, and it changed the industry completely, in my opinion.
That's really good.
Thank you.
That's
yeah, I agree. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
You want another one, Tom? That I could
no,
give you? I got another one, but I was only given that.
Okay. I'll be very cliche. The British Invasion and Watchmen. I think that was
my other one. But.
Yeah, that Watchmen and the rest of the influence of British writers in comics has probably been, for me as a reader, the biggest, most important change, because that forced comics to grow up at a time that I was growing up. So comics kind of grew up and evolved as I did. So, guys, great topic. We went over way too much and way not enough. So,
way.
So
it's quite
a
conundrum we're in right now. Huh?
All right.
How do you edit that?
Guys, we're going to wrap up this topic. That means it's time to go over to the news desk, and it is time for the return of Wire to Wire Comic News.
Yeah.
These are your top headlines for the week of July 10th, 2006. Fans of the classic horror and suspense comics of yesteryear will be happy to hear about the upcoming publication of Fiendish Fables, a new anthology releasing from Narwhane in late August. Diamond Comic Distributors has highlighted the book with a certified cool ranking in their June previews catalog. Fiendish Fables is the brainchild of writer John Schlimm Jr., who set out to create a collection of creepy tales inspired by the classic horror comics that define the genre. Anyone who's familiar with the timeless works of EC and Warren will recognize Schlimm's use of storytelling techniques made famous by those pioneering publishers. Twist endings, cruel revenge, horrific irony, and tragic moral lessons. Fiendish Fables is suggested for mature readers and features 48 pages of beautifully grayscaled black and white artwork for $3.49. It is available in August. Neil Gaiman, the New York Times bestselling author, currently garnering massive amounts of critical praise for his latest comics work, The Eternals, is taking center stage in the newest issue of Marvel Spotlight, and it features an exclusive interview with the world-famous singer-songwriter Tori Amos, who dishes to Marvel Spotlight about her long-standing friendship and admiration for the writer. Tori Amos established a friendship with Neil Gaiman before her album Little Earthquakes made seismic shocks through the world of alternative music. Pick up the next issue of Marvel Spotlight to learn how Gaiman acted as a type of spiritual mentor and confidant to her, how they have referenced each other in their past works, and their hopes to collaborate in the future. Viper Comics has announced that they will release a limited edition A Dummy's Guide to Danger No. 1 variant at the 2006 San Diego Comic-Con. Painted with an almost Norman Rockwell-like stroke by Minnesota-based artist Scott Schomburg, the exclusive print will be limited to 150 copies. Combining elements of humor, mystery, and horror, the four-issue A Dummy's Guide to Danger centers on a private investigator and his partner, a paraplegic ventriloquist dummy that believes he was shot in the back by an assailant and has become crippled when the bullet lodged into his spine. Together since they were kids, the mismatched pair must now track down a gruesome killer known only as the Flesh Collector. For more information on Viper Comics and A Dummy's Guide to Danger, visit www.vipercomics.com. This September, we'll see the return of one of the most popular graphic novels of recent years, The Bone, One Volume Edition. The massive 5-pound, 1,300-page paperback by Jeff Smith is being brought back by popular demand. The paperback tome, which originally retailed for $39.95, has been out of print for more than a year and regularly sells for over $100 on eBay. The return was made possible by an arrangement between Cartoon Books and Scholastic / Graphics, the current publisher of Bone. The original black and white Bone, one volume edition, debuted at Comic-Con International in San Diego in 2004 and sold 50,000 copies before being taken out of print the following year to make way for Scholastic's full-color versions. The one-volume edition has been named one of the 10 greatest graphic novels of all time by Time Magazine, Book of the Year by the Comics Journal, and earned a starred review in Publishers Weekly. For more information and to see the complete new cover art, visit www.boneville.com. According to a report by Wizard Entertainment, Warren Ellis was quoted as saying Fell was canceled. However, Mr. Ellis decided to clear matters up himself. This is quoted from WarrenEllis.com. The Wizard reporter, who was well outside comfortable earshot in my Sunday panel, said, "Fans hoping for more volumes of Fell will be disappointed to learn that the author has no plans to return to the series." Ellis said, "One is enough. I think it has got the ball rolling for other people. Casanova is out right now. I think there's going to be at least one more book in the Fell format in the next 6 months from Image." However, the question actually asked was, "Will you do any more books in the Fell format?" Around Comics is glad to hear that Fell isn't going anywhere. The incredibly successful Marvel Zombies miniseries is now being collected in an oversized hardcover featuring an all-new cover. The cover of the hardcover features an all-new zombie homage to the cover of Secret Wars No. 1. The Marvel Zombies hardcover collects all 5 issues of the widely praised miniseries, along with a host of extras. The oversized treatment includes every cover that graced the Marvel Zombies issues, including the variant covers of the multiple back-to-press issues, along with the covers of the classic issues those covers pay homage to. Robert Kirkman and Sean Phillips took the spin-off from the Ultimate Fantastic Four, where Earth was devastated by superpowered zombies, and carried it to unexpected heights. Marvel Zombies hardcover is on sale August 9th and will retail for $19.99. Top Cow Productions is giving readers ultimate value and great reading for the bookshelf with its new compendium editions. The massive 1,248-page volumes will encapsulate years of great story and art in hardcover collections at the bargain price of only $49.99. The compendium line launches in August as the Witchblade Compendium Volume 1 hits stores. Top Cow's acclaimed Witchblade 1 through 50 gets the deluxe treatment. The origin of Sarah Pazzini, the Witchblade Bearer, is revealed here along with 50 issues of great stories by top-notch talent. 1 month later, the Tomb Raider Compendium will raid stores in September. Dan Jurgens, Andy Park, Michael Turner, Tony Daniel, and many more outstanding creators packed 50 issues worth of action into this volume with Tales of the Tomb Raider, Lara Croft. In advance of February 2007's Darkness video game release, the Darkness Compendium will hit in October. Supernatural mafia hitman Jackie Estacado oozes blood and power in tales by Garth Ennis, Paul Jenkins, Mark Silvestri, Joe Menendez, and more. These have been your top headlines. For the full version of these and other stories, go to www.aroundcomics.com, your source for the best in comics news, reviews, and opinions. Alright, those are your top headlines for the week. This is actually a recap. We skipped a week for the news last week, so we're going to do a little catch-up here. Let's start off with Fiendish Fables coming out from Narwhane. Our good friend Dave Wachter has a tremendous 6-page story coming out in that, so we definitely wanted to give that some play. You guys have seen the preview pages. Are you excited about Fiendish Fables?
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, I think it's Dave's best work so far. I hope he does more horror stuff, because I think...
Got a great feel for
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
I like
yeah.
it when he does that style. that he used in that story.
Yeah, when he grayscales his own work, it's tremendous. And hey, it's a anthology horror series, $3.50.
48 pages. Beautifully grayscaled black and white artwork.
You can't beat it. So if you've liked Dave's work in Scar Tissue, it's even better than that. And from what he tells me, that the rest of the anthology is just tremendous. So definitely pre-order Fiendish Fables if you have a chance. It was in the June previews, June 06. 3277 was your preview code there.
Ding!
Neil, this is one that I know Tom loved because you posted a forum on it. Neil Gaiman and Tori Amos are quite chummy with each other.
God, that just figures.
I don't.
Neil Gaiman, honestly, you're hanging out with Tori Amos. I don't care how black of a leather jacket you wear or how sad of a book you write. If you're hanging out with Tori Amos, you are a pussy.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Ow.
Well, it depends on your definition of hanging out, I guess.
Little Earthquakes was a fantastic record.
Oh, God. Yeah.
All I can say on this is that the only thing I can imagine more boring than maybe listening to Neil Gaiman is listening to Tori Amos talking about Neil Gaiman.
Can you imagine their conversation? Oh, I just...
We're never going to get Neil
Gaiman
on the show.
Songs for Pele was great. No, Sandman was great.
I love his work. I just, you know...
For a dissenting opinion, I don't mind listening to Neil Gaiman, and I have some of his audiobooks and different things.
Well, now I look like a dick.
Dick?
Well, you are a dick.
Sorry.
We're just kidding.
I like Tori Amos and Neil Gaiman.
It would
so
that would have to be
I don't care about Neil Gaiman and Tori Amos together.
I love 1602.
And I like Little Earthquakes. All right, guys. Viper Comics is releasing a special edition, A Dummy's Guide to Danger. Bob, you're going to be out in San Diego.
Damn them, because I ordered number one from DCBS, and now I'll probably have to buy the variant at San Diego from these bastards.
Get there early. There is only 150 copies, and now all 12 of our listeners know that, so there's only like 138.
If you have a limited run of 150 books that you're putting out at San Diego, you are pussies. That's what the news is. Theme of the
Tom,
news.
Well, if the people at Viper Comics are listening to this show, save one of those for me.
Send one to us. At Dark Tower Comics. We'll give it to Bob.
Bob?
I'll be there in San Diego.
I would love that. Please pick me up a copy of that. I'll give you the money.
There's only 150.
There's only 150.
What do you think? He's trying to get his own.
What if some kid is behind?
Hopefully
him
they'll
who
be
wants
there on
pre
take
right.
it from that kid.
Next
All right.
issue.
Next story.
Bone fans.
Yes.
Yay.
50,000 copies.
Will you stop?
And all Bone fans are pussies, according to Tom Cater.
Good Lord, Tom. Okay, there's that explicit tick. Yeah. Explicit.
Yeah, we
tag.
Went an hour 40 without touching it.
Thanks,
now
Tom.
Tom's just blowing up.
Fucking he's talking about cats.
So Jeff Smith's Bone, the first printing of this sold 50,000 copies, and now it is coming back to print. So, Bob, do you have the... I'm sure you have the first print.
I got the hardcover of it at San Diego when it came out. There was a much more limited run of the hardcover of the one.
Bob has Jeff Smith in a case.
Interestingly, Jeff Smith used to do a lot more at San Diego. I mean, he's kind of a celebrity now. He doesn't come there. But I used to get the hardcovers when they'd come out for that series as they came out, and I would get him to sign them every year at San Diego.
Well, you know, you are a super collector, so are you going to take it to the next level and start collecting creators?
Oh, yeah.
Is that next?
I have little cryogenic capsules in my garage.
You're going to be sticking close to Carmen Infantino.
Oh, geez.
Hey, no!
You're cruel, Tom. He knows that because I mentioned to Tom that Carmine is going to be at San Diego next week, and I will
love
be.
Carmen Infantino.
Well, I will say any Bone fans should check out his website, Jeff Smith's website, because it's
Boneville.
It's got some fascinating stories about his, you know, up and comings when he was, you know, first putting out that book.
This is a book that I have the Watchman principle, because I have the original issues, I have the hardcovers, I have the, you know, there was 8 or 10 of them, then I have the one volume hardcover, I have the one volume soft cover that I got so that I gave it to my
audiobook.
Kids so that they could read it.
and you're wondering why single issues will never die.
But then also, now they're doing color hardcovers of it from Scholastic Books, and I'm getting the color ones when they come out too. I love Bone. So,
all right, guys, wizard who we are not friends nor enemies of.
I heard Fell was canceled.
A lot of people heard that Fell was canceled.
Is this really a
pulled
story?
A Spider Girl.
A news story.
Yeah, you know, don't believe everything that you read or hear, especially if it's on AroundComics.com.
Amazing Spider-Man is getting canceled out here.
Spider-Girl is canceled.
All right. And the story is that a writer at Wizard website overheard Warren Ellis talking about Fell, and he misinterpreted what he said, and then he put up on their website that Fell was going to be canceled.
Nice editing.
But it's not. Fell is not being canceled.
Fell is staying around, so... Yeah. Marvel Zombies is going to hardcover.
Yay! I can finally read it.
Yeah, they're gonna reprint all of the covers, all of the variant covers. There's going to be a new cover for the hardcover. There was lots of cover.
Wow.
In a lot of coverage in that cover.
My driver's license has an alternate zombie version that got printed. That's not very funny.
I think they should do.
You are right, sir.
Yeah.
They should do what they did with like the super ultimate fifth edition of Day of the Dead. What was that?
Night of the Living Dead or Dawn
of the Living Dead? Dawn of the Dead, Land of the Dead.
Where are you going?
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead.
The DVD they did like the
Book of the Dead.
Yeah, the Book of the Dead,
rubbery.
The leather, the fake leather or flesh.
Well, so anyway, oversized hardcover of Marvel Zombies is coming out for a very nice price of $20, $19.99.
Considering Secret Wars cost like this. Soft cover costs like $25 bucks.
Oh, the first issue of Marvel Zombies is going for $35 now.
I'm getting this just because I have the issues.
I'm bringing mine in.
But I didn't buy, you know, they put out so many second, third, fourth printings with different variant covers. I don't buy variants.
I got the first.
So this is a way that I can get an all-in-one place, all the different variant covers, which is the only reason why you buy.
What was great about those variant covers is that they were all zombie versions of classic
Marvel comics,
which made a lot of fun.
Beautiful.
Guys, Top Cow's releasing
compendiums.
The Witchblade omnibus.
You didn't need to collect your whole 100 issues of Witchblade. You could have just waited, and they would have.
Chris,
given.
I found someone else in your boat.
I'm
Bob,
stopping
right
Witchblade
here.
At 100.
Oh, Jesus.
We're gonna hug now.
Yeah.
You.
Hey, it comes out this Wednesday, Chris. You want to get a drink on Wednesday night to celebrate?
I am
the
getting
100th
these omnibuses,
issue.
Though. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, for the. The prices, you know, for 50 issues, 1,200 pages. The Tomb Raider one came out, mm-hmm. The Darkness, and now Witchblade.
Yeah, it's 1,248 pages, $50. Witchblade 1 through 50, and you know, I'm sorry, but Witchblade 1 through 50, those are damn good stories. At the time, I really enjoyed that series. The last 50, I really haven't read them. I still.
I have no idea what they're
doing. I have no idea what's going on.
I stopped reading it for a long time. I started reading it again when Ron Mars started writing it. But it's, I'm kind of done.
I'm just wanting to see, like, the next, you know, everybody has their own sort of word for what their edition is, you know, absolute, compendium, you know, omnibus. It's like, when is
absolute.
It, you know, when are they going to run out of
Soul
you know,
Crusher. It's the next series of.
It's the boom Soul Crusher version of talent.
So there you this go. Thing will destroy you, this book.
All right, guys, that is our news for the week. I'm glad to have it back, so I hope everyone enjoyed it. I would imagine next week we'll have a whole nother load of news. And then the week after that, we're going to go crazy because it's going to be all of the San Diego Con announcements.
We're going to go apeshit on you.
There you go again. You got to swear?
What
are you, a child? You got to.
I am like a child who's gotten the green light.
Jokers. Okay,
hey, I did want to mention one other news story that wasn't in the news, but it came out today, and I'm really excited about it, is the redoing the EC comic hardcovers for $50. There's two of them, the Weird Tales of Weird Science.
I believe
Science,
you said that was like porn.
Oh, I can't wait for
those,
man.
Are they in color?
Yes, they are
I've
in color.
I've got all the Russ Cochran. One, you know, the whole EC
that they did,
library
.
That's all the oversized black and white ones.
These are.
I talked to Bruce Rosenberger today, and he asked me the same thing. He's like, "Are they in color?" I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Oh, I've got all the black and white ones." Damn.
I don't know if I'm going to rebuy them all again. But if you don't have them, I probably won't get them because I have the black and whites. But
you have all the original EC.
No, I don't have. I'm not that old, but. I would recommend. I mean, that's some classic stuff. And if you don't have the black and white ones like Bruce R. and I,
well, I'm really excited.
Definitely worth checking out.
I just started like slowly collecting a few here and there of EC comic stuff, and it's, you know, they're hard to get and they're expensive, and so I'm really happy so I can stop doing that and just buy these instead.
Oh, and they're gonna look good on the bookshelf. Oh, yeah. And hey, it's comic history, and it's history. It is. It's history. Embrace it. All right, guys. That's our Wire to Wire news. Let's move away from the news desk. It is time for Top of the Stack. That's right. It's Top of the Stack. Our chance to let you, the listener, know what the panel has been reading for the last week. Who would like to go first with their top of the stack?
Me. Oh. Mr. Cate.
Tom had his hand up first, and he called me Mr. Cate.
Ooh.
Tom, what is your top of the stack?
Ultimate Fantastic Four, number 31, by Millar and Land.
Don't you spoil this book for me.
I'm not going to spoil it for you. It's Millar, sorry.
I call him Millar.
I picked this solely for one huge reason. The villains in the book actually tricked me as well as the characters that they were trying to trick. And very rarely does that happen in comics where I sit there and go, how did they do that? And then say, oh, shit, of course, that's how they did it. So I applaud that. It was great to actually read a book where that I got surprised. So
yeah,
that's my top of the stack.
Same here. I loved that book. I thought it was great. And the thing
the
I thought
end was
oh,
great
just fantastic.
Too, yeah.
And the thing I thought when I finished reading is like, God, I'm really gonna miss Mark Millar or Mark
if
Miller
you like,
on that book.
If you like the idea of the Fantastic Four, but you can't find a Fantastic Four book to read, like I have for many years, this book get the Miller. Run,
yeah,
which has been fantastic.
Just great.
And that's
I'm really worried about the whole Ultimate one.
All four.
I love Ultimate Fantastic Four and the Ultimates. Ultimate X-Men, I can take it or leave it. I still get
it. Since Robert Kirkman started writing it,
it's okay. It's not great. It's definitely not Kirkman's best stuff. And Ultimate Spider-Man, I still enjoy it, but I really look forward to Ultimate FF and Ultimates. And Miller's leaving both of the books, and I'm bummed.
Yeah, well.
We'll see.
Let's see what goes on with the next top of the stack. Who wants to go next?
Sal.
I picked Ghost Rider number 1 by Daniel Way and Mark Teixeira. I am an old fan of Ghost Rider, and I really like this issue. I thought it had a good feel for the character, the history of the character.
Which Ghost Rider is it?
That's sort of the question. I don't. Yes, and I didn't care for the mini that
I stopped
Enos
buying
did.
That after issue 2. So yeah. On your recommendation, I'll pick up this one because I hadn't ordered it.
I didn't care for it either. And like I said, I love the character Ghost Rider. Unfortunately, that character for some reason is hard to write because he's one of those characters whose concept is a little cooler than what he lends to a story or an ongoing story. Sort of like Silver Surfer, you know, cool concept. But I thought that Daniel Way obviously had a good grasp on the history of the character. Or the histories, I should say, because that's the only thing that bothered me about the book is I don't know what Ghost Rider is. It looks like the Daniel Ketch. Is that?
Daniel Ketch.
It looks like that Ghost Rider, the Spirit of Vengeance, but I think it's Johnny Blaze. They haven't really said yet.
Well, that'll make sense since the movie's coming out next year.
Yeah.
It's going to be Johnny Blaze.
But it didn't bother me so much, and I thought that they did a really nice job of setting up what's going to come next and giving him a better characterization of, because a lot of times with Ghost Rider it's like he's just this demonic creature that doesn't have a whole lot of personality other than I'm gonna kick your ass or I'm pissed off because I'm Ghost Rider
or I'm on fire and I look cool.
But this was a bit more characterization of that character and developing that and developing the story where I think some really cool things, and it has Satan in it, which I really enjoyed. It's not like some demon pretending to be Satan.
It is Satan.
It is hell. It is Satan. And the whole
Mephisto here.
And the whole concept that they sort of introduced about that character and Satan and his power and what he's able to do and what hell is like was really interesting too. So, Ghost Rider number 1, I really liked it.
Guest of honor.
Okay.
Brutal.
I have chosen Batman Legends of the Dark Knight. Number 208 is out this week.
Uh-huh.
And the first part should still be in the shops. It's a new arc by Bruce Jones and Ariel Olivetti. And I had stopped buying Legends of the Dark Knight, and I started buying it again with 207. I really like Ariel Olivetti's art, and I think this is an artist that will be seeing more of. This is a good book if you like a Batman story. Actually, a lot of the Batman books, we're going to have a double Batman week this week.
Yes.
But
double Batarang.
Legends of the Dark Knight, this arc.
I haven't been this excited about Batman books. I mean, that was something like I always, it was like you have this amazing character, Batman, and for some reason Marvel put, or I mean DC put like the worst writers and artists on it for years. And
well, they didn't have to. Yeah.
But now they're coming out, you know, it's like now I have to buy Batman, I have to buy Detective because they're just going to be great.
That's a good segue for me. My top of the stack actually from last week, and we didn't have a chance to do it, so I carried it over because it was just that good, is Detective Comics number 821. And
yay.
Mark, thank you very much. Mark, the manager here at Dark Tower, said you need to pick up this issue of Detective. It is written by Paul Dini. Is it Dini?
I don't know. I don't know the man.
And art by, he actually worked on the Batman animated series. And art is done by J.H. Williams III. And
John to his friends.
Yeah, John to his friends. If you're familiar with Desolation Jones, this is the same artist that I fell in love with on Desolation Jones. And in Detective Comics, takes it to a totally different level. Williams' art in this book is just absolutely stunning. I said earlier on the show, I'm a graphic designer by trade, and I really enjoy when an artist is able to add a graphic element to their art to take it beyond, you know, just your standard sequential storytelling. And Williams really adds a design element to his art, and it is absolutely stunning. One of the things I really enjoyed, a lot of the facial. Yeah, it's Bob's pointing out there's a page close to the front of the book that has a whole rogues gallery of Batman villains as he's trying to figure out who is behind this particular crime that's going on in Gotham. And he's thinking about all of the rogues gallery, and they're like in this, you know, big daisy chain around the bat head as he's thinking about it. It's like, okay, it's not Ivy, it's not Joker, it's not Two-Face or whoever.
Batman's rogues gallery.
Did I say?
Because the rogues gallery, according to the DC guide, belongs to the Flash. So
yeah.
Just want to clear that up for everyone.
Well, technically, there is no Flash right now. He doesn't have a girl.
One last point on the art. I loved Williams. A lot of his facial drawings, almost a Paul Pope aesthetic to them that I really enjoyed. If you liked Batman Year 100, he kind of echoes that a little bit. Paul Dini's story, what I really liked about this more than anything else, self-contained, one story, and it was the best single-issue Batman crime story that I've read in years. It had all of the main components. It had Batman, it had Bruce Wayne, it had Alfred, had Robin, had a crime syndicate, and a mystery. It had Jim Gordon. It was a perfect single issue Batman story. And
yeah, talk about self contained. I mean, that issue.
That's it.
Yeah, but at the same time, it started developing other things that I think you'll see as the story progresses.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And
it was so refreshing to have a single issue Batman story that I didn't feel cheated on, and at the same time, it played out perfectly. I felt like there was a beginning, a middle, and an end, and there was no cheating of the story. So, if you haven't been reading Detective Comics, the Paul Dini, J.H. Williams, number 821. Pick it up at your comic shop if it's still there. I really enjoyed it. We've got three bonus top of the stacks this week. Matt Summer has been hanging out here in the shop. Matt, real quick, what is your top of the stack this week?
Well, Chris, this is a totally off-the-shelf random pick that I just looked at because
it
looked kind of cool. Yeah. No, the cover is kind of interesting. No, this is from Dark Horse Comics called Scarlet Traces, The Great Game by Ian Edgington, someone I've never heard of before, and art by somebody named Disraeli, who, again, I thought was the Prime Minister of England, but apparently he's a good artist as well. This is a four-issue miniseries, $2.99 per issue, and now, you guys know I'm an English teacher, so I'm kind of a literature nerd, and basically the premise of the story is that it's another kind of sequel takeoff to War of the Worlds. Like, and there's been a bunch of those, like freaking Killraven is a sequel supposedly to War of the Worlds. But in this book, the basically the premise is, I guess, that in 1898, after the Martians all died, spoiler alert from the flu, you know, the Brits took those Martian ships and they took them apart and they took the technology. And so they have a real advanced society. It's in the story is set in 1938 or something. And so they have really advanced technology. They can travel to different worlds. And the British Army is involved right now. They're on Mars fighting against the Martians. And it's kind of a weird whole V for Vendetta kind of conspiracy thing. Something strange is going on. The art design, the spaceships and everything kind of reminds me of Crimson Skies, the board game or the Xbox game. I don't know if you guys ever played that, but
art is really
it's
nice.
It's also sequel to an original hardcover that came out a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's like a, if you go on Barnes & Noble and search Scarlet Traces, it comes up. It was like how that new League of Extraordinary Gentlemen's an original graphic novel and hardcover. There's a Scarlet Traces book like that, but I don't think you need to read that to understand that book.
Well, I hope not. The first issue is, it is kind of a little disorienting because you don't really know what the hell's going on so far, and it ends on a cliffhanger. But I don't know. Like I said, if you enjoyed stuff like V for Vendetta, or if you want to see what happens next after the War of the Worlds, I guess.
Nice, cool. Matt, thank you for dropping by as always.
No problem.
Our next top of the stack is not even a comic top of the stack, but we have another one of our buddies has dropped by the shop tonight to say howdy. Bernie Gonzalez, how you doing, sir?
Not too bad. How are you guys doing?
All right, Bernie. We're on the forums this week, and there is a premiere from Sci-Fi Channel coming out, and you like this just about as much as I did. So, let us know about your top of the stack.
Yeah, very very rarely do I actually geek out about something, and once I found out about this, I just had to share it. It's Mike Mignola's Amazing Screw-On Head. It was a one-shot from Dark Horse released a few years ago. It actually won the Eisner for Best Humor One-Shot. And after that, gained some popularity in Hollywood enough that they decided to translate it to the animated medium. It was made into a pilot. Unfortunately, that pilot got lost in development hell when they couldn't get an on-air deal for it. But now, I guess luckily for us, we get to see it for free online because Sci-Fi Channel is airing it. It's a little over 22 minutes long, but you can watch it. It's free. It's, from what I understand, a pretty solid translation of the one-shot. And at the end, they have a survey you can fill out. I guess if they get enough positive feedback, they'll try to translate it into an actual ongoing series. But it's a really good series. It's Mignola's art translated into the animated form. If you like humor along the lines of Hellboy, Venture Brothers, then it's right up your alley. And it's free, so it's the best top of the stack on this episode anyways.
It was a great translation of Mignola's art. And Bernie actually posted on the forum such amazing lines as, your pretty vengeance fetish will now have to do without Mr. Groin, is one immortal line out of it. Followed by my favorite, if by candy you mean ancient forbidden evil, then yes, I told you not to put it in your mouth.
But also delivered by Paul Giamatti, David Hyde Pierce, and guest star Molly Shannon. Chris didn't exactly give them too much credit as far as his impersonation. But it's
David
really
Hyde, so David Hyde Pierce in this is awesome.
He is.
What was my favorite line is, any last words before I spark one up? So, and you just have to watch the trailer.
All right, you geeks.
So Amazing Screw-On Head was amazing. So please check that out.
Aptly
named. We're gonna leave you on top of the stack with a listener top of the stack. So if you are listening out there, you have some comics that you've been reading in the last month or so that you would like to spread the good word about, record it, send it in, and here's an audio top of the stack from our good friend, Mr. John Hook.
Hello, my name is John Hook, and this is my listener top of the stack. I will be reviewing Shadow Pact number 2 by DC Comics. Shadow Pact is written and penciled by Bill Willingham. It is inked by Wayne Foucher, lettered by Pat Brousseau, colored by Chris Chuckery, and edited by Joey Cavalieri. Shadow Pact is a spin-off title from the miniseries Day of Vengeance from the Infinite Crisis. Shadow Pact, it's only at issue 2. This is a great title for new readers to jump in on if they're looking for stories that have great story and, you know, looking for comics with great story and great art. Fans of Bill Willingham's, and not just of his Fables work, but especially of his old Elementals work from Kimiko, I think would greatly enjoy this title as well, since Bill is back to back illustrating a comic as well as writing. And I'm a huge fan of Bill's artwork. Shadow Pact is only at the second issue, so a brief recap of issue number 1 is a magical team of villains known as the Pentacle have come to a small town in Wyoming and have completely isolated that town in a magical bubble. And no one, Superman, Green Lantern, no one was able to penetrate that bubble to get inside. And so the Phantom Stranger was able to come and open up a doorway in the bubble just long enough for the Shadow Pact team to enter and get sealed up inside. And what's interesting about this title is it's running in 2 timelines, because DC is running 2 different storylines in their books. The 52 weekly series, which is occurring a year ago and will get eventually caught up, and then all the primary titles are occurring 1 year later. So what's interesting is the Phantom Stranger is camped outside of this bubble waiting for the Shadow Pact team to hopefully come out victorious, and it's 1 year later. So we know for sure that the Shadow Pact team spends at least a year inside that bubble. But the storyline inside the bubble is a year ago, and so we're just seeing the beginnings of their adventure inside that bubble. So it's really cool. The Shadow Pact team is made up of Nightmaster, Enchantress, Nightshade, Detective Chimp, Blue Devil, and Ragman. So this is a very interesting, eclectic group of magical characters. And they are facing off a group of villains known as the Pentacle. And they're also a group of characters that are very, it seems, very evenly matched to the Shadow Pact, and it's even surmised that, and wondered, that maybe fate had a hand in creating the Shadow Pact team to combat the Pentacle in just this particular event. So we'll see how that unfolds. I want to keep this review spoiler-free, because I do encourage anyone who's remotely interested to please pick up this title and check it out. Again, it's only 2 issues into it, and you don't need to have the Day of Vengeance miniseries to fully understand this team, although it would be interesting to have the Day of Vengeance, because that way you get the you'll get an understanding of the origin of the Shadow Pact team. The Shadow Pact book itself is not covering the origin of the team, because that was covered in the Day of Vengeance miniseries. So right from the get-go, you're able to get into an action-adventure story where the team is already fully formed, fully developed, and they're going in and able to work as a cohesive group, or at least as cohesive a group as they can be this early in their career. So that's about it. Highly recommend Shadow Pact, and it's a great fun read, and I hope everyone will give it a try. Again, this is John Hook. This is my listener top of the stack for Shadow Pact number 2. Thank you.
All right, John, thank you very much for that top of the stack. Please check out Shadow Pack if you have not. Guys, that's going to do it for the meat of the show. Let's wrap things up with a few announcements. Mr. Caters.
If you don't already know, we are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. The CPN is a collection of the best comic book podcasts on the net. You can learn more about the network and find more great podcasts at comicpodcasts.com. And it is great. The internet's very divisive, and I think you'll find a lot of very interesting and welcoming places at the network. So,
and it's comics, it's podcasts.
Comics podcasts.
Oh, sorry.
Two S's.
Comics
S-S.
Podcasts.
Plurals.
Com.
Dot, yeah.
Oh, yeah, com, yeah.
Guys,
it's like whitehouse.com.
This show, probably more than any other for a little while. Thank you so much for the post this week. It gave us so much meat to go over on the topic. So thank you so much. Please go to aroundcomics.com. Visit us at the forum. We post new episodes usually on every Tuesday, so you can chime in. It gives us a lot to talk about. Makes it possible for us to talk about things that you want us to discuss. So
we get to be lazy.
Yes, and we get to be lazy.
Join our fantastic team of research monkeys.
Yes.
And I'd like to thank Chris and Sal and Tom for having me here to the show, and I would love to thank them for introducing me to Dark Tower Comics. I bought some things here, and I would highly recommend any comics-loving visitor to the Windy City to find their way here to Dark Tower Comics, because this is a very good comic shop. I've been in many comic shops in my life. A lot of them fall below the bar. This one sets a very high bar. It's very, good. Very excellent
you
shop.
You picked up Fantastic Four.
Number 36. All right. First series, Stan and Jack.
We'd like to, and we'll thank Bob here in just a second, but I do want to mention thank you to the sponsor, YouBuyNow.com.
YouBuyNow.
Check them out.
YouBuyNow.
A quick announcement. I will go ahead and let you know what we're doing next week. We're going to have Scott Johnson on. He's a poster on our forum and an incredibly accomplished artist. He does a lot of licensing for Marvel. And we're
exclusively
gonna,
now, yeah. He,
yeah.
He does. He used to do covers for like
D&D
games and different role playing game Risk and Risks. And
Risks.
But yeah, now he does exclusive stuff for Marvel.
Scott is fantastic. If you're not familiar with Scott's art, please check his stuff out at www.scottjohnsonart.com. And Scott will be here next week as we talk about licensing in comics. Bob, first of all, it's really awesome to meet you in person. We've talked over the internet for a year or so now, and we Skype pretty often. It has been an absolute pleasure to have
they
you.
They shook hands in the most masculine way possible, just to paint a picture.
It was, you know.
For the audience, chest bump.
Well, no, I mean, I haven't talked to Bob before on the forum a little bit, posting it, but it was fascinating to talk to somebody that's collected this long, and just your knowledge and your collection is unbelievable. So
I rode the train. I rode the train with Bob, and he went over my pull list.
With a discerning
eye.
He
gets a lot more than I do. He gets a lot more. But it was a real pleasure.
Bob, and we didn't even say it at the beginning of the show. Bob is a collector that I think we should all aspire to be, in that he embraces old comics and sees them for what they are. But at the same time, he is really dialed into comics today, has not shunned modern comics. He loves comics as a medium.
Yeah. I love indies. I love mainstream. I read manga. I like all different kinds of things. As long
you
as
are
it's good.
All around comics.
That's right.
He is around comics.
All right, on good that link. Note, everyone have a fantastic week. We will be back again next Monday. Make sure to tune in on Thursday. We have a midweek episode with our good buddy John Suntress will be on. So we'll be back next Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
Comics.
If you would like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. For that and the latest in comics news and opinions, go to www.aroundcomics.com. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next week, where the panel will change, but our mission stays the same, bringing you the best in discussion, news, and reviews in and around comics.